Stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Been great today, isn't it?
I'm here. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. We are back for another Deepest Lore. And, we've moved this. We're going to do this next week, Dee, but we've moved it forward. Because various circumstances meant that I was here rather than where I was going to be this week. And hello, Dee. Dee? Has he died? Hello? Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Oh.
Hello, you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Okay.
Okay, yeah, there's a bad connection here. Yes, as I was saying before, we started the stream, we may get a chance to do it next week as well. because there's a lot of material. Yes.
Yeah, people are saying my sound is a bit low.
Yeah, you're always a bit low. I saw someone
complain
about that.
Oh, I've turned myself up a lot. How about that?
Yes.
Okay.
Good. Dominant.
Yes. So just before we get going, I do have a small announcement, which is that my Foundations of Research course is now up and running. I have yet to get round to actually making an announcement video. I was going to do it this morning, but then I got sidetracked with other things. So after this stream, I will probably do a announcement video, like a short video explaining like what's on Foundations of Research. But I have made that specifically for, I wasn't planning on making it, but then I saw the lack of general research skills about, and I thought, well, this needs to be rectified, especially if there's going to be a network of tens. And I've made it very cheap. £50, basically giving it away. It's quite a bit shorter than a lot of the other courses, but I've tried to pack in as much as I could there, and done it up to, you know, I guess what you call like world class research standards. So if you're at school or university and did that course, you'd probably be. If you did everything I said on that course, you would be leagues ahead of your classmates. I'll just put it that way. Given the state on people's research skills these days.
Well, considering it seems that most people's research involves doing a Google search and maybe reading a Wikipedia article. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw this is AA's version of how to Google, I despaired. I was like, oh god. That's literally their idea of doing research, you know. There's that. So pick it up if you haven't already. I've seen some people have bought it just from the Twitter link I put out. But grab that. And the other thing is that some people were complaining that I still haven't done the Super Chat catch-up stream from last week. I actually am claiming responsibility for fixing YouTube. YouTube is fixed now for Super Chat. And I actually spoke to a woman from Google called Daisy D, and she got it fixed. So Daisy, if you're listening, thanks for fixing the Super Chat. But apparently they're fixed for everybody now after my intervention. So there we go. The fact I got through to anyone in Google at all is amazing, isn't it? So I might do a stream like a catch-up stream later on as well, if I don't pass out. Anyway, let us get back to Andy Warhol. Now, where were we last? Somewhere in the mid-60s, I would say. We'd reached, I would say, 67.
No, we were about 1964, I would say.
64, okay, all right.
yes.
I was just judging by what Dylan looked like. But okay, only 1964. I thought that was like, that looked like 66, Dylan, but, you know.
Yeah, it's not strictly chronological. I'm jumping around a bit to kind of hit on things more thematically. So, yes, I mean, we've looked at pictures that have strayed into other years, but we're back and forth a bit. So, yeah, it's not strictly chronological.
Sorry, Dee, for my kind of linear analytical mind. You know, I can't think like an artist, you know. Anyway, okay, yes. Right, so... what are we looking at right now?
Well, when we last left Mr. Warhol, we're talking about his films, and you recall we looked at some of the screen tests. So we were just getting into talking about his foray into what was then called underground filmmaking. This is actually Mr. Warhol with his Bolex camera, which I talked about a bit, filming Marcel Duchamp, who is the gentleman on the right. And people may be familiar with Mr. Duchamp. He's one of those characters that people who don't know terribly much about art tend to get very upset about.
Isn't he the man of urinal fame?
Yes. Yeah. Among many other things. But yes, that piece is, of course, infamous. So yes, Duchamp was living in New York and lived there till the end of his life in, I think, 1968, around when he died. So, but Warhol had met him at some sort of event and made a film, made it one of the sort of screen tests of him. I mean, as I said on the last stream, there were 472 of these screen tests made. The great and the good and the anonymous. We saw quite a number of them, but there are many, 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 many more.
I still remember Lou Reed cheating with his Coca-Cola bottle.
The Coca-Cola bottle, yeah. But I mean, there's a screen test of Salvador Dali. You know, there's this, of course, this one of Duchamp.
I'd love to see that one.
I was going to include it, but I've only been able to find like just like 20 or 30 seconds of it on YouTube, and really bad copies of it. But I have seen the whole thing, and it's quite interesting because, I mean, like so many of them, at the very beginning, Dali, of course, gets this amazingly dramatic arch, you know, sort of. Yeah. Expression on his face, but you could see that, of course, he's not going to be able to hold this for like 3.5 minutes, so you get to watch him kind of slowly kind of droop.
I love the idea of his mustache starting out kind of waxing and then drooping like kind of, by the end it kind of it loses its we should mention, by the way, that your let's just say rival. You know, like how in Shakespeare's sonnets, there's a rival poet who turns up.
Yes.
Well, basically, that rival poet in your world is Pharaoh, isn't it? But hasn't Pharaoh recently been doing like a parallel three-part series on Dali?
On Dali, yes, he has, which is quite surprising, because I would say that if there was a single artist in the 20th century who followed very much the trajectory, or who Warhol followed very much the trajectory, would be Salvador Dali. I mean, there's a lot of similarities to how they conducted their career. People tend to be much more people of a sort of quote traditional bent seem to be much more favorably disposed to Dali because he paid, you know, he was generally a quite a fantastic painter and used modified versions of quote traditional techniques, yeah, well, but well, But yeah, they were very much the same in the sense of creating a character and then marketing that character relentlessly.
I've been to the Dali, like where Dali grew up. I can't remember what it's called. It's not far from Barcelona.
Yeah.
And there's like a whole like Dali town. And there's like a Dali castle museum thing that I've been
to. The theater museum, I think it's called.
It, kind of a bizarre place. It's in the middle of nowhere. I remember I used to get like a special bus trip there. It's almost like a theme, like a Dali theme park. There's a giant egg outside. It was fun. If you're ever in Barcelona, I recommend the trip. But my theory is that the reason that people get Dali more than some of these other artists is because he's very representational. It's like, you know, people, okay, this is time melting. I get that. It's a concept you can grab straight away. Whereas some of the other artists is more difficult to.
It's true. Yeah. Although Warhol, I would say, is even more representational than Dali, because you know he dispenses with the middleman and just makes silk screen of it. But
all he's doing is taking a photo. You know, he hasn't painted. You know,
yeah, well, he did. Yeah. I mean, he did both. It's worth noting that Warhol and Dali were, I would say they were friendly, and of course they did meet on a great number of occasions. Dali lived in New York for a period of time. You know, many artists European artists ended up coming to America after the 1940s and. Dali, you know, lived in New York for a time. So yes, they crossed tracks and there's many occasions over the years, up until I think the early 80s that Warhol and Dali actually had met. So so yes, Warhol knew a lot of these.
Did he see him as a friend or a rival?
Oh no, they were quite friendly. No, they were quite friendly. I mean, I think both of them certainly understood that their trajectories were parallel, but they didn't cross really.
Strong branding.
I would say of the two, of course, Warhol was much more normal than Salvador Dali. I mean, just as a person.
I mean, I was about to say, Dee, looking at this picture of him now, I mean, you were saying that he was, when he was a bit younger, quite raging. I would say, like, by the standards of 2021, he looks quite masculine to me.
Oh, he may look like it, but as soon as you saw him move and heard him talk, you would know. it actually reminds me, there was a little passage from the book Popism that I'd forgotten to read that sort of deals with this. He's talking about city. I mentioned Emil D'Antonio, his friend and filmmaker who he sort of encouraged him very early on in his career. And he's talking about having a meal at the 21 Club in New York. As we sat at 21, we talked about the art around town, about Klaus Oldenburg and Jim Dine's street exhibit, about Oldenburg's beach collages in a group show at the Martha Jackson Gallery, and so on and so forth. Dee was such good friends with both Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg that I figured he could probably tell me something I'd been wanting to know for a very long time. Why didn't they like me? Every time I saw them, they cut me dead. So when the waiter brought the brandy, I finally popped the question, and Dee said, "Okay, Andy, if you really want to hear it straight, I'll lay it out for you. You're too swish, and that upsets them." I was embarrassed, but Dee didn't stop. I'm sure he saw that my feelings were hurt, but I asked him a question. He was going to let me have the whole answer. First, he said. The post-abstract expressionist sensibility is, of course, a homosexual one. But these two guys wear three-button suits. They were in the army or navy or something. Second, you make them nervous because you collect paintings. And traditionally, artists don't buy the work of other artists. It's just not done. And third, he concluded, you're a commercial artist, which really bugs them. Because when they do commercial art, windows and other jobs, I find them, they do it just to survive. They won't even use their real names. Whereas you've won prizes. You're famous for it. Anyway, so it's sort of, I always sort of remember that as a curious little anecdote that Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns didn't like Andy because he was too camp. Of course, both Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg were also homosexuals, but it's the type of homosexual. And as I said, Warhol was very self-consciously camp. And as he said, he played it up. So.
Okay. Kind of. Now, did he get on with them or did they never like?
No, I mean, obviously later on when Warhol was quite an established figure of the in the art world, then yes, they were friendly, and certainly I would say Rauschenberg got a huge boost from Warhol basically by being inspired by Warhol's use of silkscreen to produce images. That was a huge revelation in Robert Rauschenberg's own work, because up till then he'd been doing sort of painting, but also kind of adding images to it. But he'd been doing it in his totally laborious way by putting like solvents onto newspaper and then like pressing it onto canvas or paper and rubbing it with a spoon. And, you know, it didn't have the kind of look he wanted. And so Warhol basically showed him how to do silkscreen. And it was a big revelation. And Rauschenberg's work changed dramatically. He used the silkscreen in a very different way than Warhol did, but the technique was revelatory to him. And Jasper Johns as well was friendly with Warhol. I mean, Jasper Johns is he's still around, quite sort of reclusive and withdrawn anyway. So he's not going to be a gregarious friend to someone like Warhol, who was very public in a certain way. But yes, they did become friends afterwards. But that little anecdote was about when Warhol was kind of coming onto the scene.
They were a bit wary of him.
A bit wary of him because, and as they said, I mean, they were right. At this time, the things that Warhol was doing, again, very publicly moving from commercial art to fine art, you know, being very public about being a kind of connoisseur and collector of other artists' work, being this sort of media figure that Warhol was becoming, that was all anathema to the romantic idea of the artist.
You know, this is going to be a strange comparison, but I'm reminded of the wariness of the older generation of artists. I'm slightly reminded of the way that the other playwrights took to Shakespeare when he first came around. There's the famous line from Robert Greene when he calls him an upstart crow beautified with our feathers. And I'm wondering if that's how, you know, they may have thought, well, you know, who is this guy who's just come on the scene and, you know, do you see what I mean? There's that, like that.
Yeah,
they may have been thinking like, why is he getting so much press and attention when, yeah, you know, basically we were doing this like 10 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, I'd never heard that about. I never heard that about Shakespeare, but that is quite interesting because that's probably a bit of that. There's always, I mean, you know, like every other human endeavor, there is rivalry and jealousy and professional and otherwise. So. While we're on the topic of campness and Warhol's films, there is one little film that we didn't. I think we should take a look at it now before we move on.
Okay, let me just get the film screen up.
Yeah.
we have to go through this tab because it won't play sound otherwise. So which one? Which one? Which
There's no sound, so don't worry about it. It's fine. Yeah. It's called Blowjob, 1964.
This isn't going to upset Puritan Susan, is it? She's already.
Oh no, Susan's not going to be upset. It's on YouTube anyway. If anyone, it's going to upset the audience, but that's the point, isn't it? So this is an interesting follow-on from the screen test. This is a 1964, so this is around the time of that photograph we were seeing of Warhol and Duchamp. And it is kind of characteristic of Warhol's silent films of this time.
Sorry, the film is called Blowjob, and I'm just... I mean, is he meant to be, are we looking at what I think we're looking at?
Oh, you're looking at exactly what you think you're looking at.
Oh, dearie me. So, yeah.
But again, I mean, this is very, I think very much part of the way that Warhol kind of sees the world and deals with the world. I mean, the focus is on, even though, of course, because of the title of the film, we're quite aware of what's going on. It's obviously a lascivious, it appeals to prurient interest, but where the focus is on that, and yet also we're denied any kind of satisfaction of or payoff, we're voyeuristically focused on a face. We're voyeuristically focused on reaction rather than action. And I think that this is very interesting in light of the way we think of the paintings, whether it be the car crashes or the electric chairs or Marilyn. I mean, we're constantly cast in the role of the voyeur, of the audience, of the consumer, of the watcher, rather than being actually involved in any kind of carnal thing. There's nothing carnal about this whatsoever. We're looking at a young man's face, just as those screen tests we were looking at young men and young women's faces. So it's very much a tease that doesn't deliver the payoff, even though, of course, we get the payoff, but not in the way we expect.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually reminded of that Michael Haneke film, Funny Games, from, I think it was 1997. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but that's a film where these two young men turn up basically to terrorize a young couple. And whenever there's violence, the camera just pans away, and we can hear sound, but you cannot. Like, he always denies you basically you never get to see any violence in the film. But in a way it's horrifying because your mind fills in the violence, and it's like meant to be a comment on how pornographic violence is in film. And I think Hitchcock did a bit of this as well, didn't he? Where he often like cut away at the moment where when it comes to this that we're watching here, I guess one of the things interesting is that your mind fills in what's going on down there. And, given what we were talking about with sexuality earlier on, I'm guessing that some people would fill in a man down there and other people would fill in a woman down there. Because we don't get to see who's doing it, right?
No, it's not clear. I do know who was I don't know who was doing it. It's never been revealed who was doing it, but it was a man. But in the context of the work, you never see that person. You don't know. You don't have any sound. I think it's also worth relating this to those pictures of the car crash, which, of course, we saw various supine human bodies wrecked and destroyed and bereft of life. Again, we're told what we're watching, but the human face in the throes of ecstasy is very close to the human face in the throes of death. I mean, it's so much so, of course, famously, one of the kind of French phrases for the orgasm is le petit mort, the little death. And again, I think that there's a very kind of Catholic sensibility of the connection between carnality, between the flesh and death, you know. I mean, quite literally, carnivore, you know, you're from the thing that gives you life has to be a life taken from another creature, you know, so that flesh is inevitably linked to death. I mean, even to the Blessed Sacrament, you know, that you are literally participating in, you know, in a ritual that involves the death of someone, you know, who came to save you and give their life for you. So, you know, I think that there is this constant relationship in Warhol's work between these ideas of pleasure and pain and life and death and action and reaction and all of these things. And again, I mean, you will jump to a conclusion because you're given a very, very blunt title and a very, you know, sort of obvious scenario. But what are you actually looking at? You know, what are you being told? I mean, I just always urge people who want to jump to their first instinct, you know, that I think great art, whether it be, you know, whoever, Picasso, Rubens, you know, Caravaggio, anyone, don't always take your first instinct, you know, because there may be something else there.
Hold on. It's been interrupted. I have to stop playing it. It's been interrupted due to copyright.
Has it?
Yeah. It'll come back. Oh dear.
A silent film. Oh, is the Andy Warhol? Does it say who's what the copyright was done for?
No.
I wonder if it was the Andy Warhol Museum, because they are quite obnoxiously predatory in terms of taking things down.
It will come back.
So the stream will just go back on.
It will, eventually.
Sorry about that. I didn't think that would be a problem, because that I literally took this film from YouTube.
So let's wait till it comes back on. It will come back on.
I hope so.
No, I will. I've done many tests with this.
It's so fucking obnoxious. So we'll have to shear that bit out of the stream, I guess.
It'll just come back on. It says it automatically. Yeah, there we are. We're back on, D. Back on. So, Susan the Puritan has stopped watching that. But it's apparently there's some copyright issue with playing Blowjob, so there we go.
Yeah, which is very odd, because of course this is on YouTube. I this does bring up an issue that we will get to eventually, which is the nature of the Andy Warhol Museum and the Andy Warhol Foundation and the Andy Warhol Estate, which I don't think is always a positive one. The fact that a museum devoted to proliferating and prolonging interest in an artist's work is voraciously copyright striking things. And I've seen them do it to other things on YouTube. I think there's something quite worrying about that.
You were talking about, I don't know exactly when it cuts us off, you were talking about, you know, the nature of great arts.
Yes. I mean, I think that I don't know what people will have missed, but we were watching Warhol's 1964 film called Blowjob, which depicts the face of a man who ostensibly is in the throes of ecstasy. I made the point, not to repeat myself again, I don't know what's going to be removed, but that there is quite a relationship between ecstasy and death, sex and death, which is something that I think comes up in Warhol's work all the time. But also that you're presented with this very kind of in-your-face, blunt title, which directs your mind in a certain way. But I was urging people not to jump to conclusions. You know, if you're willing to follow an artist into the unknown territories that the visual arts or music or anything else or drama can take you, then you should be willing to, you know, to suspend your assumptions about what you're going to be given by that artist. So, you know, I think one of my points through these whole streams is to get people to just stop thinking about things in these prescriptive ways.
Yeah, and one of the things I was thinking about watching it actually is that there's a kind of thin line between pleasure and pain watching it. Like he looked like he was being tortured at certain yeah. points, you know. So, and interesting. I've never been that keen on the old BJ, so I can kind of relate to that in a way. I've never been comfortable with it. So.
No comment. No comment whatsoever. I am not straying into the personal realm, but yes, but I certainly understand what you mean. And I do think that confusion of the two things is quite deliberate. Anyway, so if we want to go back to, I'm sort of afraid of watching any of these videos. I don't want this to keep happening. I thought it, since that I took most of these videos from YouTube, that there wouldn't be a problem. But
no, it's funny when it comes to things like this. So well, we can get back to the pictures if you want.
Yeah, let's go back to the pictures for a while. So if you want to go on to the next one. So again, this is Warhol and Gerard Malanga, who was his painting assistant for the most part, but certainly was also involved in the film's setup. I'm going to go on to the next one. Warhol and Malanga. The other thing I love about all these images of this, I mean, I have a huge collection of pictures of artists' ateliers and studios and such, because I'm always really fascinated about how people work, how artists work, and the sort of environment which their work comes out of. So I'm always interested in the details of these pictures. You know, the great pile of paintings there on the right in the background, or the stack of Brillo boxes and you want to go on to the next one? Again, you can see one of the screen tests being done. It sort of gives you an idea of the environment. Went on. So if you go to the next picture, well, the Warhol had a great technological leap. Around this time, I think 1965, he leveled up from the Bolex to this camera, which is called the Oricon Super 1200. And this was a camera that was, you have to remember, at this time, everything was, for the most part, still done on film. So if you were, like a news broadcast, if you were sending a camera out to film something, you know it was a film camera. You didn't have a sort of live feed through video, through digital satellite and all that stuff. It was actually done on film, and so this camera was actually produced as mostly as a journalistic camera.
It's big, isn't it?
It's a very big camera, and that was one of the advantages of it. So the Bolex held 100 feet of 60 millimeter film, which is about 3 minutes, depending on how fast you run the film. Silent film is run anywhere from 16 to 24 frames, but generally 18 frames per second. So that little bolex, you could only shoot three and a half minutes at a time. And of course, with the way that Warhol worked and his kind of interest in, the long take, if you remember Sleep from last week, which is you know, 6 hours of someone sleeping, he wanted it, which had to be done in three and a half, four minute bursts, because of course the camera had to be reloaded every three or four minutes. So this camera was good because it had that massive magazine at the top, which held, so the camera's called Oricon Super 1200. It held 1200 foot reels of film, which is almost 30 minutes of film. So you could shoot 30 minute continuous takes. And that was one advantage of this camera. The other advantage of it was that it recorded sound at the same time. So it actually recorded the sound to the film, to a stripe on the film, I believe. So this was a big upgrade for Warhol, because not only could he shoot much longer takes, but he had sound now as well. And so the nature of his films changed. Really from this time, he started to stray into kind of quasi-narratives. But of course, the hilarious joke, as there often is with Warhol's production, is that the first film that he filmed with this Oricon, this new camera, if you go to the next slide, is called Empire. And an Empire is 8 hours of the Empire State Building, a static shot of the Empire State Building. Out of the office, someone had an office which, of course, afforded this view. And Warhol and Malanga and a few other people, Jonas Mekas, I think, was there, who ran a cinema called Filmmakers Cinematheque Co-op, I believe, which showed many of Warhol's films, was sort of showed, it was a center for underground film. But they had all gone up to this office in the evening and set up the Oricon, and they filmed the Empire State Building. So it is a sound film, but there's no sound because, of course, it's a shot out the window.
Like, did anybody ever go and watch this thriller?
Oh yes. Well, this is the thing. In fact, there's an anecdote which at one point Jonas Mekas, this man who owned the cinema, this sort of underground filmmakers collective, was annoyed because Warhol wanted to leave during the screening of one of his own films, and so Mekas tied him to a chair and made him sit there and watch the entire thing, you know. And Warhol says in one of his books that, you know, people didn't understand the fact that he didn't always want to be exposed to his own products. And he says, well, sometimes you want to be bored and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you can sit on the, you know, sit on the in the garden and stare at the sky for 4 hours, and sometimes you can't sit still for 2 minutes.
He was strapped clockwork orange style, being
forced to watch his own films. Yeah. So I do like that anecdote. Yes, and of course people did, you know, people certainly who were devotees of underground film. I mean, these were all very interesting experiments.
Fascinating. Tell me on this, right? I can't see the point of watching the Empire State Building for 8 hours.
Well, I think the fact that you have to ask what the point is the point, you know. I mean, I think there's an implicit kind of joke to these things, you know. I mean, will you actually sit and watch nothing, or ostensibly nothing, for this long? Well, no, I've never watched this one in its entirety, but again, we stray into the realms of a kind of conceptual art. I mean, this in a sense, these films were kind of weird analogues of Warhol's paintings. As you remember, the many, many repetitions, you know, there are hundreds of repeated silk screens of Marilyn Monroe or car crashes or whatever. I mean, the film is literally frame after frame after frame. You know, one foot of 60 millimeter film is 40 frames, so that's 40 pictures of the Empire State Building times 1,000 times 10,000.
I'd like to imagine it's Warhol's tongue-in-cheek critique of the long lingering shots from French new wave cinema.
Well, I do think that there was a bit of that, you know, again, because of course most of the films were associated with the underground film scene were quite serious, and certainly that anything coming out of Europe at that time, I think was quite sort of serious. And I think in Warhol's work, there's always a sense of it being a kind of a lark, you know. It's both serious, but it's also a joke, and it was always presented that way, you know. I mean, Warhol was never said, you know, oh, you should take. Me seriously. I'm a serious artist. It was always what you see is what you get. There is nothing behind the surface of my films. There's nothing behind the surface of my paintings. There's nothing behind the surface of me. There, what you see is what you get. Of course, that's a lie, but that was always how he presented himself. There was never this stereotypical artist, you know, oh, you've got to understand the meaning of this film of Empire. No, it's a boring 8-hour film of the Empire State Building.
Have you ever watched the full 8 hours of Empire?
No, I just said a couple minutes ago, I've never watched it. No, nor have I ever watched Sleep in its entirety. You know, nor have I ever watched most of these in their entirety. I don't think I could. I don't even like to watch narrative films, really. I'm not really much of a cinema person. I have to be quite invested in it to give the time. What's funny about Empire, of course, is that he makes the most mundane things. So the film starts in the evening, and at a certain point in the film, I don't know when it happens, the lights come on. In the building, they turn the, you know, the exterior lights. In this still, you see it. It's illuminated, yeah. You know, as it is at night, and it's almost like this huge dramatic moment. It's the only thing that happens in the film. It's the only event in the film is the building lighting up. And you know, I have watched about 10 minutes of it. Around that point, and you know, it does hilariously seem like, you know, the most exciting thing in the world because something happens. So yes, there's, and that's embedded in it. I mean, people, I think people are taking this all too seriously. I think it's this strange position of being both serious and a joke. And there's something very American.
My theory is that he just hated art critics and wanted to torture them. So maybe.
Well, then maybe there may be a bit of that as well. Anyway, you want to move on.
Okay.
So, of course, you know, the Empire, I mean, again, the big joke that his first signed film was silent in nature. But he did, of course, immediately start making lots and lots of films. And as I said, once the signed was a part of it, then narrative crept into it. So, that this is actually him filming this woman called Marie Menken, who was a friend of his, a fellow experimental filmmaker and a kind of hilarious character who he described as looking like Broderick Crawford in drag. You know who Broderick Crawford was, an old Hollywood character actor. So next. Speaking of drag.
Yes.
One huge aspect of Warhol's scene and his work eventually was this fascination with drag queens. Now I need to disabuse people of any kind of contemporary notion you have of drag and trans and all this nonsense that we're inundated with every day. At this time, all of these things, the campness, the homosexual subculture, drag, transsexualism, this was all still a fringe, you know, world at the time that Warhol was kind of going into this. There were you were certainly not going to get corporate approval for kind of sticking your camera or your nose into these worlds. I mean, and of course, you know, in Warhol's case, many of the people who he was interested in were sort of desperate characters. I mean, this is this person is called Mario Amaya, who was, I believe, a Puerto Rican postman who, in his spare time, liked to dress up very badly in drag and sing songs. And so Warhol, of course, attached himself to these kind of characters, these characters who were both kind of living at odds with, you know, kind of everything around them, the world around them, and also not quite doing it well. You know, that there was always a sense with many of Warhol's kind of the subjects of his films and the subjects of his interests, this slight desperate aspect of failure. You know, that these people were clinging on to the edge, but you knew they weren't going to make it. You know, that they were going to fall off. They didn't quite get there. You know, no one was ever going to be sold on the fact that this was a woman. This is always going to be a man in bad drag. Desperation is there.
You say that, Dee, but by the standards of 2021 and the low effort the low effort trend you see these days, he's actually more effective than that.
We're returning to that world.
Can I just mention that when I read The Philosophy of Andy Warhol, he's got this rather strange section where he talks about, like, you know, he reckons that men who dress up as women are the hardest working people of all, because it's very, very hard work for a man to become a woman. And there's a kind of a strain, like, he breaks it down. He's like, what's the most difficult? A woman who wants to be a man who wants to dress like a woman, a man to be a man, or a woman to be a woman. And he says, well, it's harder work to be a woman in general because of all the makeup and so on. But it's even harder for a man to be a woman because men are so unwomanlike, I guess. So it's kind of interesting.
And there's an anecdote in one of the books where he was filming this particular chap, Mario Amaya, and I may be calling him by the wrong name. I have to check. he zooms in on his forearms, which are quite sort of hairy. And this guy was quite upset about that. He was just like, "Oh, you're taking the piss out of me by kind of focusing on this aspect that's you know, that obviously reveals the veneer of you know, the veneer of sort of cracking at the seams." Mm-hmm.
Should we carry on?
Okay, so you want to go on to the next? Yeah, I'm sorry, it's not Mario Amaya. My brain isn't working. Anyway, I'll find the name and pop it in maybe the comments something later on. But Mario Amaya was an art critic. Apologies to the family of Mario Amaya for calling him a bad drag queen. This is Chelsea Girls, which is a film that you've probably heard of. Mm-hmm. One of Warhol's kind of most well-known films of this period. And Chelsea Girls is basically a series of these vignettes. You know, as I said, I mean, once he got this sign camera, he would just film these scenarios using people that were...
I think I know Chelsea Girl as a Nico album.
Yes,
and as a Leonard Cohen song. I want to say there's a Leonard Cohen song about Chelsea Girl as well.
Yeah, I mean, so the name of this film comes from a place called the Chelsea Hotel, which was on.
I've seen the Chelsea Hotel as well.
Which is on 23rd Street in New York. At the time, you know, it was it already had a kind of reputation as a kind of bohemian place. I believe, like, you know, Dylan Thomas and Virgil Thompson and various people had stayed there or even lived there. I mean, many of these hotels and cities, you could also kind of live there like a flat. And so a lot of the people in the Warhol kind of crowd, the people that congregated around Warhol's scene and in the factory, stayed there. You know, they lived at the Chelsea Hotel. And so the film Chelsea Girls, it's the kind of gimmick of it is that you're ostensibly supposed to think of each of these scenes, each of these vignettes, as maybe taking place in different rooms of the hotel. They weren't all filmed at the hotel. I think a couple of them were. Most of them filmed at Warhol's studio or elsewhere. But I mean, it's the sort of narrative structure that the film hangs on. The Chelsea Hotel, of course, Bob Dylan for a time lived there. This is where he wrote, like, Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands was written at the Chelsea Hotel.
He mentioned it later on in the song Sarah on Desire. He says, I remember well sitting in the Chelsea Hotel writing Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands for you.
That may be how I know that he wrote that song there. But yes, he was living there at the time, around this time. So it was a very well known place. And again, a lot of the characters that we will associate with Warhol, such as Nico, who you can see here on the right, or
can I just mention very briefly? Little AAA has got one of those brushes with the, you know, the, I don't know what you call it, the, you know, it's not a hard brush. It's got that.
Yeah.
Hair, it's got hair brush.
Yeah. Bristles. Pink bristles. Yes.
Yeah. I've never understood how, like, the point of those. I've never really got, I think my grandmother had one as well. What's the deal with those?
I think the idea is that they massage your scalp. Although I don't know, I mean, I use.
You ever use one?
I use a Mason Pearson brush and a comb. So.
Anyway, carry on.
Anyway, so technically the way Chelsea Girls works is that it's projected, it's two projectors, projecting two different reels of film side by side. So. The reason it has this very long narrow aspect ratio, it's not filmed in CinemaScope or Cinerama. It's actually two 16mm films running side by side. And when you watch it, it's about 3.5 hours long, but you're really getting like 6 or 7 hours of film because you're watching two things at the same time. Because of the way Warhol operated this time, it was all very casual. So I would think that at different times you would get different combinations of film when you watched it. I don't think it was always projected in the same way. Some of the bits of film are silent. Sometimes you have both of the films have dialogue assigned going at the same time. So you're really you're kind of taking in two. You know, kind of it's binocular, and so it's quite interesting. Bits of it of color as well. You can go to the next slide and see the color.
I seem to remember the Velvet Underground do that on several of their songs, where you've got one speaker doing one thing and another speaker doing another thing. I'm trying to remember which album it is. Is it on? Not the Velvet Underground and Nico, but the next one. I think it's just called the Velvet Underground.
The Velvet Underground, yeah.
Yeah, but there's songs on there where you have essentially a split song. Yeah. You know, John Cale's doing one thing on one speaker and Lou Reed's doing something else on the other speaker.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if they, because I know they were associated with Warhol, but whether they were kind of trying to do their own version of that in sound.
Could be. I mean, that of course happened, you know, as well. I mean, famously, the Beatles did that. If you ever want to have fun sometime, listen to the song Space Oddity, Bowie's Space Oddity, and put with headphones and pan, like go to where you can switch from the balance. And if you pan left and right, the audio channels are almost completely isolated from each other. So if you pan to one side the whole way, you will hear Bowie singing the harmony. And if you pan to the other side, you'll hear him singing the melody. So it's totally the stereo picture is totally separated into two monaural channels. And that of course came after this. And so I do wonder to what extent these experiments fed into, you know, the Beatles and all these other kind of experiments with sound, and certainly with pictures and superimpositions. As we know, Warhol, of course, with those Elvis paintings, was already playing with ideas, you know, 3, 4, 5 years earlier than this, with ideas of kind of overlapping images and kind of presenting, you know, two oppositional pictures right on top of each other. You know, so there was a lot of kind of experimentation with overlapping and overdubbing and channel mixing. Yeah.
Okay.
So I was going to have us look at a chunk of a little piece of the Chelsea Girls, but I don't think we should chance it.
I think the problem we had with Blowjob D is that we watched too much of it in a row without pausing or talking or I've with AA Radio, I've got to know the system very well. It doesn't like streaming. It's actually happier. If you notice, the AA radios are all preloaded.
Yeah.
It's actually happier with it that way. Done in that way rather than live streamed. And when it is a live stream, we need to pause it and talk over it to say that there's commentary or whatever. Otherwise the algorithm basically thinks that we are trying to just show it, you know, as a kind of
right
pirate airing or something.
Products, and plus we have that. Yeah, we did have it on full screen. I suppose that may have something to do with it, but Chelsea Girls is on.
It's just
YouTube,
a robot, so it's quite stupid.
It's
we could try to play it within YouTube if you want.
Do you want to just watch a minute of it just to give people an idea?
Yeah, that's
okay. If you just search in YouTube for Chelsea Girls Warhol, you'll get it. It's not a very good copy. I have seen this. I have seen this projected, 16mm projection in a cinema. So, I have seen many of the more narrative films.
Andy Warhol, Paul Morrissey. Yeah.
Paul Morrissey didn't have anything to do with Chelsea Girls, but maybe it's just tagged that way.
Yeah. Look, so it's tagged. Okay.
Oh, that's it. So yeah. If you just skip to any random point, just drop the, you know.
Yeah, okay, let's try here.
You can, yeah.
Okay, so we've got Nico in the kitchen, somebody in a different room.
Yeah, I believe that's a character called Ondine, or Pope Ondine, as he called himself, who was one of those amphetamine people that Warhol knew. Yeah, you want to be. Oh, she was quite striking. I mean, a total disaster, but quite striking.
Very low voice as well. I mean, I can't remember that. There's one album I've got of hers, which is really quite haunting. It's one of the later ones. I don't remember what it is now. It's actually quite experimental. It's almost like a horror album. I don't remember what it's called.
Some of her solo efforts are quite interesting. Quite interesting.
The Marble Index. The Marble Index.
Marble Index. Yeah. If you if people want if you if you look around for sort of live performances of Nico. I mean, she really, what happened to her later on? It's quite sad. We're actually going to see a little snippet and something else before we move on, where you'll see that. So if you just want to drop it somewhere else, just want to give people a flavor of this.
Oh, who's this? What's going on here?
So that's, I can't remember who is who there. You know, that for some of these, there would be a scenario. There'd be a narrative scenario. So I know in the one on the left, that was like, you know, it's meant to be someone with their rent boy, the hustler. And then I think at a certain point, the drag queen postman that we talked about comes in and sings to them. That woman on the right is a person that will come up there. You see her? You want to be careful because there's nudity in this film. So
the hell is that going on?
The woman on the right is called Bridget Berlin. She's a very important character in Warhol's life. She's actually the daughter of the chairman of the Hearst Corporation.
So there's literally an orgy going on the left, and like some.
Yeah, there's not literally an orgy. No, there's no sex in Chelsea Girls. It's sort of simulated. There's Mary Warnoff on the left there. And on the right, yeah. But I think this is actually quite a fascinating film. I was thoroughly captivated watching it. It's very interesting, kind of the overlap of the you know, the sound and the pictures. Yeah, there's the postman.
And is this, I mean, is it done kind of like in a cinema verite style, you're just kind of watching it like a fly on the wall?
Yeah, it's just like a fly on the wall, you know. Play a bit of this section. It's quite nice. The color bits are really nice. They're very much, I would say, of the time, you know. You very much have that kind of 60s coloration to some of these bits.
Yeah. It looks quite, I mean, I might give this a watch with a cigar at some point.
Play a bit of that bit with Nico in the spot. So it's a
this bit.
It's a very nice. Yeah. They are not good because they are not good. They are lying, stony miseries. There's a scene where this man like slaps a woman across the face, and I'm really horrific. But the interplay between the two scenes, even though of course they're not actually related, but your mind tries to make relationships between what you're seeing, and it's quite interesting, I think.
Do you know, if I was casting Scarface in 1964. I reckon Nico would have not been a bad pick for Tony Montana's wife, you know.
Oh yeah.
She's got that kind of slightly coked out vibe, basically, you know.
Yeah.
Did she ever appear in any actual films, Nico?
I think she may have. I'm not entirely sure. As I said, her personal life was more and more a disaster as time went on. She had a child, of course, in the 60s at this time, who she always claimed whose father was Alain Delon, the French actor, and I believe that her son Ari went to court to try to prove that he was an heir to Alain Delon because he was his son. I don't know what happened with the dispensation of that, but
All right. Okay. So.
All right.
I fear Susan. Yeah. Again.
Yeah. Before we move off the Chelsea Girls, there's a film in the Drive folder we can watch for a minute.
Let me have a look. I need to get that back up. Hold on. Mm-hmm.
Oh, so you know what?
Did Nico actually look after that child of his, or?
Yeah, just go back to the images because I've not put it there for fear of a copyright problem. But it was made in the later 70s, and it's Nico singing her song Chelsea Girls. She her solo album, I think her first solo album, has a song about Chelsea Girls. But people should look it up because it's quite interesting, and she's quite haunting. As I said, yeah, she did look after her son. In fact, she was living with him in Spain in the 1980s, I think, when she died. She'd gone off on her bike to score some marijuana, and she fell off her bike and I think died of a brain hemorrhage. So,
oh dear. Okay, right. So here's JFK. A picture of JFK.
Yeah, I'm not sure what he's doing up there, but it's just Warhol fiddling around with the film there. You see all the boxes with the 100-foot rolls of film there. Next. So this is during the filming of one of the Warhol movies. I believe it might be Bike Boy, but I'm not sure. There are many, many of these films, and many of them are very hard to see. I mean, it's not easy to kind of watch any of these early films other than going to kind of screenings at museums. But you can kind of see the atmosphere that popped up around the making of these films. And I think that this contributed to the sort of social scene that developed at Warhol's studio at the factory at this time, because it almost became kind of like a whole social scene in itself, almost kind of like a nightclub or like a the place to be seen.
I'm kind of interested, Dee, by this background minion here. If you have a look. What now? I have an eye for these things. What is this fat man doing in the background?
I can't tell if could be Henry Gelbzler, who I mentioned, who was a curator at the Metropolitan Museum and a good friend of Warhol's, but I can't confirm that. I do know that I think the woman on the sofa is Jane Holzer, who was a socialite who basically got involved in the Warhol scene for something to do, so she didn't have to be a bored house, sort of rich housewife.
I'm being told by Lady of Shalott, one of the wine mums, D, that Nico's son was in fact adopted by Alain Delon's mother.
Oh, okay. So yes, Alain Delon was his father then, I suppose.
So his grandmother adopted him.
Grandmother, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this guy's got serious, like, Ruber on Unpopular Opinion vibes.
Oh, Ruber would never have survived in this scene, I have to say.
All right, let's carry on.
All right, go on. Again, another filming. This is the scene from the film that's called Bike Boy, and you see the various Warhol people crowded around. But actually, interestingly, I think that looks to me like they're experimenting with video, with a very early analog video camera. You see all that kind of electronic equipment on the table there. Yeah. I don't know the story of that, but anyway, it gives you an idea of the kind of party scene that developed around these films, which spilled over. So you notice the person on the motorbike there.
Yeah, who is that?
Yeah, well, if you go to the next slide, you'll see who it is.
Oh yes, this is what's her name? Eve Sedgwick.
Edie Sedgwick.
Edie Sedgwick.
Edie Sedgwick. Yeah, Yes, yeah. Edith Minton Sedgwick. She was, of course, most famously associated with Warhol around this time. She was the... her family, I think both sides of her family were kind of New England old money. I know the Minterns, and both Minton and Sedgwick were names kind of associated way back. I mean, they may have even been like sort of, you know, Mayflower era emigres to America. So she came, you know, came from a wealthy family. This is very much like I mentioned Bridget Berlin or Bridget Polk in that one scene from the Chelsea Girls. Another one of these Warhol characters who was, you know, the daughter of a kind of scion, you know, or the kind of child of a very privileged upbringing. I mean, Edie lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and she sort of had this whole crowd around Harvard University, which then became associated with the Warhol scene. They'd all moved to New York. But, yeah, we just...
She's got... people are remarking about her eyebrows. What's going on there? What, she looks like a badger, D.
Yeah, she's very heavily made up. I mean, of course, it was very much the style of the time. To have quite exaggerated makeup. I mean, remember, this is like, you know, right after, you know, Elizabeth Taylor and Cleopatra, and, you know, say that very extreme sort of theatrical style.
She also looks about 12 years old. How old is she here? She can't be, but she can't be much older than 20.
She's 18 to 20. Yeah.
She looks young, though.
Yeah. Well, of course, she was, you know, a very much a kind of pioneer of this look, the kind of elfin, you know, the sort of small elfin kind of Bob Pixie, manic pixie dream girl of the 1960s, you know, associated with people like Twiggy. But I think Edie Sedgwick was a big sort of progenitor of that style. I'll just read a little bit of Warhol's recollection. In January of 1965, I met Edith Minton Sedgwick. She'd just come to New York that summer. She'd been in a car accident and her right arm was in a cast. We were introduced by Lester Persky, but we were bound to meet anyway, since I'd gotten to know quite a few people from the Cambridge-Harvard group she was part of. A lot of them hung out at the San Remo. The San Remo is that, remember that cafe where all the amphetamine queens that we talked about on the last stream, that then became sort of denizens of Warhol's scene. Edie's family went all the way back to the Pilgrims. She was related to the Cabots, the Lodges, the Lowells. Her great-uncle Ellery had been the editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and her great-grandfather was Reverend Endicott Peabody, the founder of the Groton School. And somebody on her grandmother's side had invented some basic industry like the trolley or the elevator, so they were rich too. Edie's parents had moved far away from New England as you could get, California, but her brother was an undergraduate at Harvard and Edie was in Cambridge too. She was studying sculpture with Lily Swan Saarinen, the ex-wife of the famous architect Eero Saarinen, and living in a small studio on Brattle Street where Longfellow and people like that had lived in all those glamorous old houses. She used to drive around town in her Mercedes to parties, lots of them given by her own brother. The two Sedgwicks were beautiful, rich kids who knew how to have a good time in Cambridge. So I don't want to get too much into it. There's a lot of information about Edie Sedgwick, including various films. So, you know, I don't want to get too in-depth into her as a character, but I would say that she's one of the fixtures that is indelibly associated with Warhol at this time.
I actually had a bit that I wanted to read out, Dee, from The Philosophy of Andy Warhol.
All
because,
right.
Am I correct in thinking that this is Taxi?
This is, yes. Yeah, so in The Philosophy of Andy Warhol, Edie is called Taxi. He calls her Taxi. I don't know what the reason for that is.
Just about a page or so, but it's kind of stuck with me because there's something a bit strange about Warhol's fascination with this girl, and the way he talks about her. Let me just read it, because it's kind of stuck with me ever since I've read it, and I still can't put my finger on why I find this a bit strange. But he says, Taxi was from Charleston, South Carolina, a confused, beautiful debutante who'd split with her family and come to New York. She was poignantly vacant. She had a poignantly vacant, vulnerable quality that made her a reflection of everybody's private fantasies. Taxi could be anything you wanted her to be, a little girl, a woman, intelligent, dumb, rich, poor, anything. She was a wonderful, beautiful blank, the mystique to end all mystiques. She was also a compulsive liar. She just couldn't tell the truth about anything. And what an actress. She could really turn on the tears. She could somehow always make you believe her, and that's how she got what she wanted. Taxi invented the miniskirt. I just love the way he just kind of drops in kind of matter-of-fact statements like this. Mm-hmm. She was trying to prove to her family back in Charleston that she could live on nothing. So she would go to the Lower East Side and buy the cheapest clothes, which happened to be little girls' skirts. And her waist was so tiny she could get away with it. 50 cents a skirt. She was the first person to wear ballet tights as a complete outfit, with big earrings to dress it up. She was an innovator out of necessity as well as fun. And the big fashion magazines picked up on her look right away. She was pretty incredible. We were introduced to her by a mutual friend who had just made a fortune promoting a new concept in kitchen appliances on television quiz shows. After one look at Taxi, I could see she had more problems than anybody I'd ever met. She was beautiful, but so sick. I was really intrigued. She was living off her the end of her money. She still had a nice Sutton Place apartment. And now and then she would talk to a rich friend into giving her a wad. As I said, she could turn on the tears and get anything she wanted. In the beginning, I had no idea how many drugs Taxi took. But as we saw more and more of each other, it began to dawn on me how much of a problem she had. Next in importance for her, after taking the drugs, was having the drugs, hoarding them. She would hop in a limousine and make a run to Philly, crying the whole way that she had no amphetamines. And somehow she would always get them, because there was something about Taxi. Then she would add to it the pound she had stashed away at the bottom of her footlocker. One of her rich friends even tried to set her up in the fashion business, designing her own line of clothes. She bought a loft from 29th Street outright from a schlock designer who had just bought a condominium in Florida and wanted to leave the city fast. The sponsor friend took over the operation of the whole loft with seven seamstresses still at her machines and brought Taxi in to start designing. The mechanics of the business were all set up, and all she had to do was come up with designs that were basically no more than copies of the outfit she'd styled for herself. She wound up, and I'll just skip this bit a second to get down to this bit about her lying, because I find it really odd. She says, at first I thought that Taxi only hoarded drugs. I knew that hoarding is a kind of selfishness, but I thought it was only with the drugs that she was that way. I'd see her beg people for enough for a poke, but then I'd go and file it at the bottom of her footlocker in its own envelope with a date on it. But I finally realized that Taxi was selfish about absolutely everything. One day, when she was still in the designing business, a friend and I went to visit her. There were scraps and scraps of velvets and satins all over the floor. And my friend asked if she could have a piece just large enough to make a cover for a dictionary she owned. There were thousands of scraps all over the floor, practically covering our feet. But Taxi looked at her and said, "The best time is in the morning. Just come by in the morning and look through the pails out in front, and you'll probably find something." Another time, we were riding in a cab, and she was crying that she didn't have any money, that she was poor. And she opened up her pocketbooks for a Kleenex, and I happened to catch sight of one of those clear plastic change purses all stuffed with green. I didn't bother to say anything. What was the point? But the next day I asked her, "What happened to that clear plastic purse you had yesterday that was stuffed with money?" She said it was stolen last night in a discotheque. She couldn't tell the truth about anything. So it's just a kind of strange character. But also, like, it's like Warhol latched onto this girl, was fascinated by how much trouble she was in, was fascinated by, you know, her kind of obviously damaged character, but then just kind of watched and observed her like fall apart rather than like do anything to help, or, you know, don't you think that's a bit dark?
Yes, and of course you've hit on a central criticism of Mr. Warhol from many people, including many people that knew him, certainly around this period. I mentioned that people, I think it may have been the Velvet Underground chaps who started calling him this, but they called him Drella, which was a portmanteau of Dracula and Cinderella. And I think that very much applies to what you read there. I mean, you know, he was a person who could give you the sense that you had made it, that you were on the scene, that you were famous, that you were going to go to the big time, you know, that you were going to go to the ball in the Garden and meet the prince. But also, he was a vampire, and that at the same time that he was giving you this illusion, he was also draining you of your essence. This is something, of course, if you are interested in Mr. Warhol, that you do have to contend with, because, surprise, surprise, he was a human, and being human, he was very flawed. And I think one of his greatest flaws, certainly around this time, his character changed, as we'll talk about later on, but he basically did stand idly by and watch with amusement as the people around him destroyed themselves, and filmed it, and tape recorded it, you know, and painted it.
I mean, I say that because this girl that we're looking at here was 18, and clearly, from that description, she was messed up. Now, I swing two ways on this, though, Dee, because nowadays she'd be referred to well-being services and all this sort of thing, and I'm thinking, God, you know. But then the opposite extreme is just, like, basically fueling it, or, you know, a fully grown man basically just kind of encouraging this sort of thing, yeah, in a way.
It wasn't just with Edie. It was with many of these people around him. I mean, as I said, this whole scene was populated by amphetamine junkies, heroin addicts, as we'll see later on. You know, people desperately mentally ill, people on the edge. I mean, as I said with the drag postman, you know, that there was always this air of these people, that these were people clinging desperately onto the edge of life, and that you knew they were going to fall. And again, Warhol, who was, you know, a man in his late 30s at this time, knew very well what was going to happen to these people. And his justification of it, I wish I'd kind of marked this, because he does, of course, address this several times in his various, you know, sort of published writings. That he contended that there was nothing he could do, you know, that people were going to do whatever they were going to do. You know, here we go. Whatever anyone may have thought, the truth is I never gave Edie a drug ever, not even one diet pill, nothing. She certainly was taking a lot of amphetamines and downs, but she certainly wasn't getting any of them from me. She was getting them from that doctor who was shooting up every society lady in town. Now and then, someone would accuse me of being evil, of letting people destroy themselves while I watched, just so I could film them and tape record them. But I don't think of myself as evil, just realistic. I learned when I was little that whenever I got aggressive and tried to tell someone what to do, nothing happened. I just couldn't carry it off. I learned that you actually have more power when you shut up, because at least that way people will start to maybe doubt themselves. When people are ready to, they change. They never do it before then, and sometimes they die before they get around to it. You can't make them change if they don't want to, just like when they do want to, you can't stop them. And I think that there's a grain of truth to that, but I also think that it's a massive cope.
I can see where I can see where he's coming from. And yep. I do. I mean, I was just thinking, like, with the alternative scenario, what if this girl was around today? She'd be, you know, sent to see therapists and all that. She'd be an absolute disaster, even with all that as well. Because some people just are, you know. I did see that Lady of Shalott did say, though, in the chat that when she tragically died at the age of 28, apparently he said, I wonder if she left me any money. That was his reaction.
Yep.
I mean,
yep. That's pretty cool. Well, the even worse than that, there's another. I'll have to paraphrase because I don't have the actual quote. But someone said to him with some concern that they thought that Edie was going to kill herself, and he said, "Well, oh, do you think she'll let me film it when she does?"
Oh God!
You know. So
it's pretty grim.
There was a lot of darkness, and I sort of made a joke about talking about viewing these streams as descending into hell, and in a way I think that you will see the iniquities of the 1960s as things started to fall apart, as traditions died, as ties to certain ways of life fell away. You will see these people descend into darkness, quite obviously.
I think one of the problems that we've got now, though, Dee, is that this, what we're seeing here, was kind of fringe, as you've said, and it was counter, or even counter-cultural. Now, what was once kind of very, very fringe has become basically like the dominant regime. And obviously
it's encouraged, I
don't want to say that's Warhol's fault. Of course he was doing what he was doing in the 60s, but these sorts of things can only have their power if they are maintained on the fringes of society. Their place is not like, you know, in the White House or running the thing that's happened, really, is that society's become very unbalanced because you cannot make a mainstream culture of something which is by its very nature dealing with things at the extreme end of life. Looking at this picture here, by the way, I can see the Elizabeth Taylor now. I can see it in this bit a bit more, a lot more actually. So,
yeah.
Okay.
I mean, she certainly had something. I will say about, you know, this is one thing that annoys me to no end about what has happened to Warhol and his reputation and the way he's presented now is just as you say, all of this work, all of this stuff with its sort of absolute steely-eyed glare into some of the darkest places of the 20th century and certainly of the human psyche and what happened to it as a result of modernity, is now being sold as, look how cute and cool and glamorous and you know, look how, you know, Warhol was an early pioneer of you know, trans, you know, non-binary lifestyles and all of that. Bollocks, absolutely not. I mean, the whole power of all of this is that it was, as I said, on the edge of destruction. You know, I mean, this was an extraordinarily dark scene. And I think that trying to recast this as some sort of beautiful, glamorous era, however it may have been presented, is I think one of the great crimes, and I think robs it of its power, you know. To try to normalize this stuff, which of course and at the time, and of course to Warhol and everyone else around, wasn't normal. I mean, that was the point of it. I just think it's a terrible thing to do. It's very damaging, and it also takes away its prophetic power, I would say.
Yeah, I seem to remember Quentin Crisp talking about this issue even as early as the 80s, saying that, like, you know, what's the point now? Basically, everybody's dressing up. Like, you know, there's no... Yeah. It almost takes away... Like, you can't be countercultural if everybody's doing it, basically. So it's an issue, I guess. But anyway...
One more point is that also... As we've said a number of times in these streams, this world was very small. You know, it was a very small world. And in a way, Edie Sedgwick was seeding popular culture. I mean, the fashion, you know, magazines and the media and the fashion industry and all these other things and Hollywood, they were watching this and they were picking up and taking the bits and pieces, of course, and removing the muck and processing that into mass culture. And of course, this all was extraordinarily influential in a roundabout way. I mean, not that they were saying, you know, here's Edie Sedgwick. They sort of, just like Warhol did, they picked bits and pieces as needed from her and pushed them to the masses, you know. So
I mean, they were still doing the big earrings a few years ago, weren't they? I don't know if
they cycled back to that, you know, all the time. I mean, I think Edie's also interesting because she was a person without a talent. It was very hard to say what she was. I mean, she was sort of a fascinating character, but how you could actually turn that into anything. I mean, she wasn't really an actress. She wasn't really a model. She certainly wasn't really a fashion person. She wasn't an artist. She wasn't anything, you know. I mean, I think there is some truth to Warhol saying that she was a blank. And I think also he envied her. I mean, at a certain period, I mean, they were going to everything together, almost like husband and wife, and they started to dress alike. She started to wear the same clothes that he did, and she started to dye her hair so that it matched his wigs. So there was a weird synergy between them, and I think that they both saw things in each other. I think she saw, obviously, the Cinderella part of the Drella, that maybe this was a ticket towards making something of herself, you know. But I think he also saw something in her that he maybe wanted it, you know, that he sort of envied.
Can I suggest that she did have a talent, which is the, and it's still trendy to do this in some parts of London and elsewhere. I've known people who've done this. The whole idea of going to the secondhand store in some rundown part of town and picking out something and suddenly making it cool. You know, could you say that was a talent?
I think there is a talent to that. I mean, I just meant in sort of in an organized way. I mean, as you when you read in that excerpt, she was brilliant at doing that for herself, but when she was basically set up in a business to do that professionally, she completely failed. She couldn't do it, you know. I mean, she could only do it in a certain context. I mean, and the thing, you know, about wearing tights. I mean, famously, you know, she went to a restaurant with Warhol wearing tights and a huge fur coat. And they, you know, they went to take her coat to check it. And she said, no, it's the only thing I have on. And she wasn't lying. I mean, she would literally wear a fur coat and tights and nothing else, you know. But she did have an extraordinary look to her. And people did copy it, you know, but she was never able to parlay that into anything for herself. Again, people took and took from her. I wanted to read something, and you see if this sounds familiar. Gone to the finest school, all right, Miss Lonely, but you know you only used to get juiced in it. No one has ever taught you how to live out on the street, and now you're going to have to get used to it. You say you never compromise with a mystery tramp, but now you realize he's not selling any alibis, as you stare into the vacuum of his eyes and say, do you want to make a deal? How does it feel to be on your own with no direction home, a complete unknown like a Rolling Stone? And there are many people who say that Like a Rolling Stone is actually about Edie.
Interesting. Did Dylan ever have any... He's been in the news a bit, actually, old Bobby D.
Yes.
I can talk about that in a second. But Did he have a relationship with her?
Yes, in fact, it's again not confirmed, but that they had an affair, and Warhol even talks about this in the book. That was the rumor at the time. That again, whilst he was in the Chelsea Hotel writing "Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands," that he may have been having dalliance with Edie.
And in fact, I seem to remember it's mentioned at the end of this bit about Taxi. I'm trying to remember how exactly he mentions it. While I'm looking for it, by the way, that story about Dylan that's doing the rounds at the moment, as far as I've seen, is de facto impossible. Because the dates he's accused of doing it in New York, he was famously in London filming Don't Look Back.
Filming Don't Look Back, yeah, that's what I thought.
So it's basically impossible for him to have done it. So I don't know what they're thinking of, because it's not like these people don't have like very, very well documented lives. Yeah. But like, I mean, he literally couldn't have been there. He's got an alibi, and it's Don't Look Back, and the tour he did. Yeah. Judas and all of that.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, literally that tour, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying he didn't do it or whatever. I'm just saying that it's de facto, you know, it's like, well, where were you on that night? You know,
yeah.
I was in London, yeah. You know. I'm trying to remember exactly what he said about here we go. Taxi drifted away from us after she started seeing a singer-musician who can only be described as the definitive pop star possibly of all time, who was fast gaining recognition on both sides of the Atlantic as the thinking man's Elvis Presley. I missed having her around, but I told myself that it was probably a good thing that he had taken care of it now, because maybe he know how to do it better than we had. Taxi died a few years ago in Hawaii, where an important industrialist had taken her for a rest. I hadn't seen her for years. So there we go. And I think that slightly cold, disinterested way of talking about what happened there, underneath the surface, I get the impression that there was some slight resentment against old Bobby D there. I don't know, like some passive aggression from Warhol in the way he talked about that. What do you reckon?
Yeah, it's difficult to say. I want to read another bit from like Rolling Stone. This is the part that Warhol says that people told him that Dylan, that this line in the song is, that song was about Edie and this line was about Warhol. So you tell me what you think. You shouldn't let other people get your kicks for you. You used to ride on the chrome horse with your diplomat, who carried you on his shoulder, a Siamese cat. Ain't it hard when you discover that he really wasn't where it's at, after he took from you everything he could steal?
It makes a lot of sense now. Very interesting, because I'd always assumed that he was talking about one of his old folk friends, like Joan Baez or something, you know. But this now makes a lot more sense in this context.
Yeah, it came at the right time. You know, the right time. I really do think that it certainly was about her, and that he was represented. I mean, again, in this same book, in Popism, he talks about that. You know, that people told him that Dylan hated him, and that for a time Dylan wouldn't speak to him. I mean, they were friends early on, you know, because Warhol and Malanga had dragged Warhol to all those kind of coffee houses and such, the Kettle of Fish and such, and so they were running in the same circles. And Dylan hung out at the factory a few times. Of course, we saw that screen test. And then there was a point where Dylan didn't want to have anything to do with him for a long time. Later on, they got together. There's, you know, pictures of them having dinner in the early 80s and such. But so it is curious, and there is a pattern here of Warhol dropping people, or people dropping Warhol, people who were quite closely associated with him, wanting to have nothing to do with him for a period of time, like Lou Reed, who did the same thing that Dylan did.
I mean, I can't. I'm just knowing. Knowing Dylan as I do, I can't see him being into all this that much.
His association with this, I think, was just fairly brief, you know. And obviously, I think he certainly could, as someone as perceptive as he is, I think he could sense the very dark undercurrent here.
Yeah, but also, how can I put this? I think Warhol is a creature of the city, and I think Dylan is a creature of the country. Like the sensibilities of Dylan are always rural in the final. Like his, if you look at his imagery and so on, he's always passing through a city, but he yearns to be out in the country. Whereas I feel like Warhol is the other way around, where, you know, where he feels at home, like in New York type thing.
Oh yeah, always. I mean, in Warhol, I mean, of course, was born in a very grim industrial city, and lived in cities his whole life. I mean, he did, of course, have some forays into the country. Famously, he had a huge estate in the Hamptons, which he owned with Paul Morrissey. I think you were correct there. I think that there is a different nature.
People are suggesting that Femme Fatale by Velvet Underground is also about Edie.
It could be, although I've always thought Femme Fatale is a bit more about the generic kind of factory girl, because there were a lot of girls like Edie there. I mean, like, there was another one called Ingrid Superstar, who was kind of brought in as a replacement for Edie later on. But, you know, I mean, Jane Holzer and all of these types, there were others.
I think it was just about Nico personally, but
it may just be about Nico. Yeah. But let's look at the rest of the pictures of Edie. And then there's a video of Edie and Andy that we should watch before we leave Edie behind.
Those are those sunglasses there are kind of very like early 90s Oakland. I remember those being in when I was a teenager.
Yeah, it always comes back, you know. For a time, Edie and Andy were like a couple, you know.
I don't know. I mean, that's the closest I've seen to emotion in Andy so far.
Emotion in his face.
Look, he's looking at her as if with real affection there.
Yep. That's one of the reasons I put this picture in, because, you know, as I said, when we saw those pictures of Warhol before he became Andy Warhol, you know, of those intimate pictures, you don't really see him being a human very much after that. So it is interesting, because he does seem genuinely taken by her.
Do you think he gets quite colder after this time? Maybe.
Certainly in the philosophy, he
seemed to really freeze up.
Yeah, I think he does, but I think that's a general trend throughout his life. And I think there's a reversal at the end, which, you know, whenever we get that, or seven streams from now.
I'm surprised they haven't made like a film about her starring somebody like, you know, what's her name? Hermione Granger?
Emma Watson, yeah.
Emma Watson, I reckon, you know, if she did her eyebrows a bit, could kind of part, like, she's probably a bit old for it now, but at one point she would have been the sort of person who could have played that role.
I feel like there has been a film. I think there's a film called Girl on Fire, but I don't know if that's a documentary, if it's a drama. Yeah, that's a light meter. He's taking light reading, obviously going to film her.
I mean, they obviously got on well. You can just tell in the body language between the two of them that they. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, and as Lady Shalott says, they were completely inseparable for this period, you know.
I mean, was this the original kind of gay best friend business?
Well, I think that's something that's been going on for a long time, but yeah.
I mean, that's a story for a different day, but
yeah.
Anybody wants to know about my ex-wife, God's sake. Oh. all right.
keep going.
Were you the
gay best friend?
No, I bloody wasn't.
There she is. Yeah. All right. So it's pause at this picture here. There's this was part of a famous photo shoot of you often see this picture reproduced of Edie and Andy coming out of the sewer. I thought it's quite funny.
So I don't know. I think after all that we talked about, I think these are kind of humanizing these pictures. Last ones, they really show that he, you know, regardless of the posing and so on, you can tell that he's having fun with this girl.
You won't see it again for a very long time. You won't see human Andy again for a very long time. And I do wonder if his basically totally cutting her off was a way of dealing with the fact that, you know, he was genuinely hurt by what was happening to her, and that he just felt like there was nothing he could do about it. I mean, she was quite out of control, and all that stuff about pathological lying and the hoarding and the drugs and all that, that was all absolutely true of her, you know, and shoplifting and all of these other things. Don't go on anymore. Okay. I want to go back to the video folder on the drive, because we're going to watch a very famous appearance of Mr. Warhol and Edie on the Merv Griffin Show.
Okay, let's see if I can find it.
Which, of course, has a hilarious other connotation since I've been watching Seinfeld with friends. Kramer pulls the Merv Griffin Show set into his flat.
I'm just, I have to find it again.
Oh, the file is called Edie Andy Merv Griffin Show 1965.
Hold on. Right, let me get it back up.
Kramer, where do you sleep? Backstage.
Here we go.
Pop art, underground movies, call it what you will. These two are the leaders. No party in New York is considered a success unless they are there. It's hard to explain this young lady and man. They say they don't want to be explained.
Can I just say very briefly, Dee, that I miss the this sort of voice being the kind of central authority of American culture. I'll just tell people this. Every morning, not every morning, but every once in a while, I get up with AAA at 6, 7 in the morning, and there's always this terrible show on, game show on, presented by Ellen. What's her name? Ellen Degenerate, and Ellen, you know the one that.
Yeah, Ellen Degenerate. Yes.
Ellen Degenerate, right? And it's like this game show, which is so unreal. You know when like they talk about hyper reality, where it's something so surreal and non-real that it becomes like hyper real. There's something about that show that makes me think, like, what planet was this filmed on? What alternate dimension am I looking at here? And I just miss the idea of something like this being the center of American culture rather than something like that, you know? Anyway, let's carry on.
Same. And also I miss people openly smoking on television, but
that's a different, yeah.
One is a beautiful actress, and she calls herself a superstar. The other is a young man named Andy Warhol, the creator of pop art. So here are the two leading exponents of the new scene, Edie Sedgwick and Andy Warhol.
Why did he come out to Pop Goes the Weasel? Because of pop art?
Pop art, I guess. I don't know.
So cheesy.
Corny American.
I don't miss that. I want it without the cheese, without the American.
I love mid-century cheese.
I didn't know you were going to be so formal tonight. I've been taking this tie off here. What's the matter?
It's so nerve-wracking.
Is it nerve-wracking?
People. I'm not used to having to face all these people.
Well, they're friendly. They're very friendly.
Well, this and a rather tight jacket makes it a little more frightening. It's hard to breathe.
Wants to all blow at you? No? Good evening, Andy.
I must warn you, Andy won't say a word.
Why?
He's not used to making really public appearances, so I think he'll whisper answers to me if you ask him.
Can I listen while he whispers?
Sorry.
I'll whisper to you.
Aren't you going to say one word, Andy? We're very curious, and that's why everybody is so friendly. We read much about underground movies and all of Andy's work, which we know so well. What would you first of all tell the audience, for those who might not know what underground movies are? These are not war stories.
How can I tell you? It's so far they've been visual experiments. People making movies trying to see if they could do it.
And they are not shown in theaters?
They're shown in one theater, in somewhere down in the village. It's just one theater. Otherwise, private showings.
I see.
Don't really.
What would be the subject matter, for example? They're not stories necessarily.
Some of them are.
What have been?
There's been one that's been a take. I don't dare say it. I really don't. Because everything
you
want to
whisper
it
to me, and
I'll whisper to Andy.
Then how will we know?
I don't want to be involved in that. That was all.
Edie, tell me about sleep.
Andy had a fabulous movie going with somebody sleeping for 8 hours, was it? 8 hours? 8 hours. It's true. I have to say it's true. It's an 8-hour movie, and the camera's on somebody, and all they're doing is sleeping. Well, you can see them breathing, you know.
And does it take 8 hours to watch it?
Well, those were all, that's what was all before I got in on it. Now it's all changed.
Oh, there are.
It really is.
There's dialogue now?
We have other influences, and we're going to have a big production, a real film.
Which film are you
going
to do?
Which isn't going to be 8 hours, it'll be an hour and a half.
Oh.
And it will have more than one person in it.
What's that going to be called?
Jane Eyre.
Well,
really?
But that's been done.
When? That must have been 1,000 years ago.
You mean the original story?
Yes, can you believe it? Out of the...
Is this true? Did they make Jane Eyre?
No. Underground movies, Jane Eyre is going to emerge. Literally.
And you're going to star in it?
Yes.
How will it be different?
By the way, is old Merv, are they, do you think he's sleazing on it? I reckon he's sleazing on it. I reckon he's kind of, you know, thinking well after the show, maybe. Do you know?
It's possible, although I do believe Merv was what you call a confirmed bachelor.
So oh, was he really? Was he?
Read that as you will. I don't honestly know, but, you know.
Can you imagine Jane Eyre being somewhat spacey and timeless and using the plot but putting it into a modern context? Modern context. Literally.
Really?
You don't sound convinced.
No, I am. I think it'd be an interesting experiment.
I think it'll be terrific.
You want to start?
No, you should. No. Well, are you playing Jane?
Yeah, I'll play Jane.
Oh, well, I could play Air.
Not worth it.
Don't go too far there, Renee. You made Andy laugh. Are you all right, Andy? Yeah, I heard him. He said yes. You broke the spell now.
Sorry.
Edie, tell me this.
Who is this little sidekick here? I forget his name now.
I don't know who Merv Griffin's sidekick was. No. I mean,
they always have
that was
the
thing. Yeah, I mean, like Johnny Carson had Ed McMahon. Yeah, they did always have a sidekick. I mean, even like Letterman had, what was that bald headed guy? Paul Schaefer. Yeah.
That's a drag.
What?
I don't want to hear any more of that.
Oh, yeah, stop that, will you please?
Yeah, I think it wasn't Tucker Carlson like a sidekick at one point. But
was he?
Anyway.
No.
Now, you are a superstar.
We don't have to watch the entirety of this, but I just want you to get the kind of air of it.
What's the difference between a star and a superstar?
It's two things. One is a joke, and the other is possibly a real superstar, if there could be such a thing.
Has there ever been? Let me light that for you.
There must have been a while.
Oh, honestly.
Let me light that for you, baby.
You haven't been on television before, have you?
Twice.
Oh.
And it's terrifying. It's very easy here compared to the other ones.
I know. Don't look at anybody. We're just talking. Tell me about who would you consider in the past to have been a superstar?
It does have a very sleazy kind of vibe, doesn't it?
Loving the mid-century furniture, though.
Difficult because they're fabulous stars, but I wouldn't want to say superstar is a modern word. I don't want to apply it to the past.
Well, what is your definition of a superstar?
I mean, the word superstar actually did come out of the Warhol scene. I mean, you know, that was definitely invented by one of Warhol's associates.
We may be going to like part 8 at this point, because
we might have to watch all of this by the end of this show.
I think it's worth going in depth, though. It's worth going in depth.
Yeah.
Why not? Let's just do Warhol forever.
And that remains to be seen. It may be ridiculous. If we can't get it off the ground, it'll be ridiculous. If we can do a whole movie, it'll be a superstar.
Andy, how did you discover Edie?
It could be.
Come on, you can tell.
Oh, by mistake.
By mistake?
Uh-huh.
Andy's going to tell me. Aren't you?
No, Andy's
not going to tell you.
So he literally did this his name now, Matthew. What's his name?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But he was playing Sooty here, and she did the whole interview. It's kind of interesting, though. Okay.
I mean, of course, you know, and also this kind of thing was very popular. Like, you know, for certainly for American chat shows. Like, let's have on the weird, quirky, like, artists. You know, the weird, quirky, you know, person that you know that we can slightly mock. Although I would say that actually, I'm quite impressed because, like, for instance, when you watch John Cale going on like I've Got a Secret in like 1965, you know, you really get the sense that they're kind of having a go at him, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that he's really been you know, sort of there to make fun of. But I was quite surprised that Merv is actually seems to be quite, you know, really trying to get to have a conversation with him. But,
yeah, the probably the ultimate example of an act brought on purely to be made fun of. Do you remember on AA Radio, I played a song by the legendary Stardust Cowboy, that kind of space song. I took a trip in my Gemini spaceship. If you have a look on YouTube, there is an appearance on one of these 60s shows by the legendary Stardust Cowboy. And it's obvious they brought him on to make fun. And I think he just rolls with it in the end. But yeah, it's kind of like this weird thing of the mainstream culture was still very straight-laced in the 60s. And probably the ultimate example of the straight-laced mainstream culture versus the counterculture is that Bob Dylan film we mentioned, Don't Look Back, where, I mean, he's literally with guys in bowler hats, you know. Yeah. It's literally like two people from different planets. You know, when he's talking to that journalist, and he's like, oh, Mr. Dylan, I must ask you, and it is a very strange thing to look at from that way round. And but also it's like, look at what they took from us. I mean, they didn't realize they were doing it, but also like, it's like, well, what would a world look like if you took away all those straight-laced people and just were just left with the counterculture? And, well, this is the ashes, isn't it? So, yeah.
Yeah. The other famous American example of that was Johnny Carson having Tiny Tim on all the time. You know, tiptoe through the tulips with me. You know, Tiny Tim.
I'm not aware. I haven't seen that. I don't know who Tiny Tim is.
Oh, that he is somebody that definitely needs to make it onto AA Radio. Yes. Anyway, look up Tiny Tim. You have many hours of entertainment in front of you. But yes, he was famously got married on The Tonight Show. Someone in the chat mentions Frank Zappa playing a bicycle. Yes, that's I can't remember if that was... that may have been I've Got a Secret with Steve Allen, I think. But yeah, so that was sort of a staple. Let's bring on the quirky, weird artist. Well, Salvador Dali, he comes on an episode of What's My Line. You know, so it's hilarious to see Dali sitting there with, you know, like Bennett Cerf and all these people, you know, with his moustache and his walking stick.
There are some surreal things. It's like, you know, Muhammad Ali talking to Terry Wogan and things like that, you know. Okay, so
I wanted to sort of clear something up. Merv Griffin asked her, you know, where do we see these films? And she says playing at one cinema in the village. Here you see actually many of the films that they made were screened at the factory at Warhol's studio. But Warhol also had a contract around this time with a place called the Garrick Theatre, which was a flea pit cinema, run down sort of cinema. And for, I want to say a few years, this cinema basically showed Warhol films. And when it wasn't being used for to show the films, Zappa and the Mothers of Invention were kind of artists in residence there and played shows on alternate nights or off nights when they weren't showing the film. So there was a relationship between Zappa and Warhol as well, and I think they got on quite well.
I should mention that I've definitely seen Tiny Tim before.
Okay, now that I'm looking, you look at pictures of him. Yes,
I've definitely come across this guy right there. Sorry, I wasn't aware that he was. Okay, yes.
Let's skip ahead. So, as I said, I mean, the factory really developed into kind of a party scene around this time. I mean, there's Warhol. So that's Henry Geldzahler. Geldzahler. Yeah. So Henry Geldzahler was, as I said, an assistant curator at the Metropolitan Museum and a huge promoter of this sort of generation of artists at the time. Also famously painted by David Hockney. One of David Hockney's double portraits in the 70s was of Henry Geldzahler and his partner at the time. And Hockney and Geldzahler were great friends. Hockney drew and painted Henry quite a number of times over the years.
Sorry to bring it back to Tiny Tim, but I'm remembering now where I first came across him. Back in 1993, he made an appearance on WWF Wrestling. There was a character called there's a famous wrestler called Jerry the King Lawler, who became a commentator
I know. Yeah, is he the one that had the famous?
He had the feud with Andy Kaufman.
Kaufman, yeah.
Yeah, where Kaufman broke his neck and all that sort of stuff. well, anyway. Jerry the King Lawler had a segment called The King's Court, which was like a kind of chat show, but within wrestling. And Tiny Tim appeared on there. And I think he started crying or something, like Lawler made him cry. And it's all coming back to me. And then, obviously, you know, through that, I got to know him. That's what happened. Lawler smashed his little ukulele. On the King's Court, and so that's where I first know him from. And yes, my brother's saying that was the era where people used to chant Burger King at Jerry the King Lawler. Yeah. Anyway, let's carry on. Here's Warhol with his fat friend.
Warhol with Henry.
he's a patron, friend. Right? He's a patron. This guy. He's like
he's a museum curator and an art historian. Who befriended Warhol early on, and then they were good friends throughout Warhol's life. But Henry Geldzahler was quite an important figure in arts, the art world at this time. Anyway, next. So I'm just included some pictures to give people kind of the character of the kind of social aspect of the studio. The chap on the left is Billy Name, who is was the sort of de facto kind of manager of the scene here, who's the one who lived in the back of the factory.
Yeah, we saw him last week, didn't we? Yeah. I remember him now.
Yeah.
That's Leary, on the right.
There's that's definitely Lou Reed. I can't remember the name of that woman. Is it Benedetta Barzini? I can't remember. Is that Sterling Morrison there on the far? All right. Anyway, all right.
Interesting. Is that that bin reminds me a little bit of Oscar the Grouch? Of course, they would have had those bins.
It is a one of these.
Okay, this is
Andy having a bit of a wrestle with someone. I'm not sure who that is, but
looks a bit Bowie-ish, though, doesn't he, in a way, kind of like mid-70s Bowie look.
There's someone passed out on the sofa. I mean, you also get a sense of the kind of, you know, griminess of this place.
Yeah, it's grimy, isn't it? Very grimy.
trying to recast this as the glamorous silver era, but it's quite a grotty, terrible place. I mean, it was a huge crumbling industrial loft. And also, remember, at this time, as these parties are going on, Warhol is producing an enormous number of pictures. So there was full-scale art production happening in the midst of all this madness. Although that generally happened during the day, and then the party thing would sort of come on in the evening. There's Warhol and Jane Holzer. Again, that society wife who came down there just to entertain herself. And she's still around. She's now an art collector. She's absolutely minted because of her collection. Her collection's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. There's Gerard Malanga and one of the girls dancing on a big cake.
There's Bob Dylan.
There's Andy and Bob looking at that double Elvis painting that Dylan traded to Albert Grossman for a sofa.
You can cut the tension with a knife. Now we know the backstory with these two.
I know. This may have been slightly before the situation with Edie. So
Andy Warhol saying, in 40 years' time, 50 years' time, there'll be a show, a little-known show on the internet called Deepest Law, and I'm going to make it to part three before you.
Wow.
Is that Yoko Ono? That's Yoko Ono.
That is Yoko Ono, yeah.
Wow. Do you know, yeah. I tried to put a Yoko Ono song onto her AA radio, and it was just blocked. She is... Yoko Ono estate is not up for sharing any works, unfortunately.
No, absolutely not.
I thought I'd really torture the trucks by playing it, but I thought it was quite a good track. But anyway,
yeah, I'm not as down on Yoko. I mean, also people should keep in mind that Yoko was, before she was, you know, famous for being Lenin's consort, she was an artist. She was an avant-garde artist associated with a movement called Fluxus, although she was more of a based in London at the time. She started out in this kind of fringe art scene. Here's the factory being raided by the police. You can see that incongruous policeman on the left.
Yeah, what's going on here?
It was frequently raided. I mean, you know, there's hundreds of people there having a party.
Who's this chap with the bowler hat here just wandering around?
Oh, I don't know.
He's lucky he's wandered in from a Charlie Chaplin movie.
I mean, there's... you're going to find every phenotype person hanging out at the factory at this time.
If people are... Not that anybody in the entire world will be wondering, but she's got one good album, Yoko Ono. I'm trying to remember what it's called now. It was the one... It's around 1973, she had a good album. I'm trying to remember.
Everyone skips the Yoko tracks on Double Fantasy.
No, I mean that's not much cop. But anyway, I can't remember.
Anyway,
right now, but okay.
Yeah, there's a fairly well known posed portrait of the scene there, but again, I'm always struck at how grim this the 47th Street factory was.
Can you imagine sitting on that sofa? I'm guessing nobody was sitting on it.
It was a very big thing amongst this crowd to scavenge things. So pretty much everything that was in the factory was found on the streets of New York. So. It's difficult to, I mean, because now we're seeing, you know, Warhol pieces go for £100 million or $100 million in auctions and such, and seeing it in museums and being famous. But at this time, of course, it was not, you know, I mean, it was a glamorous fringe, but, you know, this was not the glittering, you know, place of the elites at the time. It's a cutout. Those four.
The, Yeah, they're not really there.
No, in fact, you can see Gerard Malanga there on the left, and he's also there cut out. That's actually from a Richard Avedon portrait that was done of various factory denizens. So yeah, there's a cutout. So
can I just say that's very kind of like train spotting, this pose here. And I'm just kind of, there's a curious mix of like this guy here, if you have a look.
Taylor Mead, yes.
He looks like a 50s teddy boy in the way he's dressed. Whereas this guy here looks like he's straight out of the 1980s.
Gerard, yeah.
It's kind of interesting that you can see the forwards and backwards styles all the same.
Yeah. This is the era when a lot of these styles sort of, you know, came in or were revived, you know, and this was also an era where people were starting to kind of revive Victorian and if you look Edwardian at him, right, things.
That was basically David Hasselhoff's look in the 80s. That's like Knight Rider, right?
Yeah. Well, that's that was, you know, that was also the kind of leather, like, you know, the queer leather bar sort of thing. Even though Gerard Malanga was not gay, but they would picked up this style.
Fans of mid 90s Manchester United. That was later pioneered by David May. That behaviour there. And that's a very obscure football joke that about three.
I don't understand.
Nobody, even football fans, won't understand that reference. But if you do get it, I'm glad you're laughing somewhere. All right, let's carry on.
All right, so party aside, I mean, there was still artwork going on at the time. So I want to kind of shift back to the paintings that were being done around this period. So I want to go to the next slide. So this is from a handout given by, I believe, the New York City Police Department in conjunction with the FBI of the most wanted men. See Jean-Victor Giusto there with the description, reward, you know, crime background, all this. And around this time, Warhol, through Henry Gelzeler and through other connections, was asked to produce an artwork for the New York World's Fair, which was happened in, we're going back a bit, this is 1964, famously the New York World's Fair. And so Warhol decided that what his work was going to be was portraits of the 13 most wanted men from this booklet. So if you go ahead. So there's Billy Naim and Warhol, but you can see the acetates for some of these
most wanted men paintings.
The thing I really like about this series is, of course, again, it's Warhol's kind of multivalent joke. I mean, because of course it's using these mass-produced images. Now, of course, he's gone from Marilyn Monroe to mugshots of criminals, but to him, this was the same thing. You know, that these were the. I mean, Marilyn may have been the most famous starlet of the 1950s and early 60s. Well, these were the most famous criminals, and so in Warhol's parlance, they were just as much sort of superstars of their own milieu as was Marilyn or Elvis or anyone else. You know, so it was this idea that, you know, that again, the modernism's, the glare of fame shone on the good and the bad and the high and the low just alike, you know. Also, I like the double entendre of most wanted men being a reference again to the sexual nature, you know, the idea of these also being kind of rough masculine characters, rough trade, so to speak. So they're both wanted men by the FBI, but they also might be wanted men by other people, you know. So I think it's quite a clever combination of things. You want to go to the next one? So there's Warhol with the, again, another one of the acetates. So if you go to the next slide, you can actually see this mural installed on the New York Pavilion at the World's Fair. And these were, you know, huge, printed on painted wood, plywood, and installed in a grid.
Fascinating, this one. Just the idea of doing it in the first place is kind of interesting. I'm also reminded weirdly of a Leon Herring series of sketches where every once in a while they take out this book called Men of 1973 and they just feature like a random one. It's kind of like a similar idea, only these were criminals, of course. So can you imagine? I mean, the thing is with these guys is that you can only imagine what rough characters they were and what what sorts of things they would have seen.
Yep. So of course, now if you stay with this one, so the amazing thing, of course, is that Warhol decided to do this. I mean, this was a very, very risky thing to do, given the time and the circumstances of it. I'm sorry, I was mistaken. I think it was actually through Warhol's friendship with Philip Johnson, the architect, that Warhol was asked to do a piece of art for the World's Fair. And so, so Warhol, you know, printed these things and they were installed. The whole thing was 20 feet, 5x5 squares, and it was installed on the 15th of April in 1964. The next day, Philip Johnson, on the 16th of April, 2 weeks before the fair was supposed to open, Philip Johnson, the architect, called Warhol and said that he had been informed that the work must be removed or replaced within 24 hours. The reason given was that the governor of New York at the time, who was Nelson Rockefeller, was concerned that the images would be insulting to a segment of his electorate, because almost all of the men that Warhol had chosen for this mural were Italian. Whether that was the official reason that it was going to upset Italian Americans, whether that is true or not, because they're all criminals, but you know, I love the implication of that. Yeah, it's going to upset the Italians because, of course, they're all fucking members of the mafia.
But he didn't do it out of concern for the families or concern for the law or anything. He did it out of concern for annoying the mafia. I mean, that's so New York, isn't it?
Who knows what the actual reason was? Warhol, you know, said that he had different stories, and that one of them was that then Warhol became concerned because, you know, that if any of these men were identified, then they might blame him, and you know, so a myriad of reasons. But this was basically up for one day and then painted over. It was painted over in metallic silver, and that's how it remained for the entirety of the World's Fair.
Can I just mention, though, Dee, it would be remiss of me to leave this piece behind without mentioning dishonest chin, dishonest forehead, dishonest nose.
You know. Oh, there's a hell of a display of physiognomy in this piece.
Yeah, I mean, that's one reason you know physiognomy is real, because criminals have. Although this guy on the left here looks a little bit like Andrew Ryan from the BioShock games, or indeed Walt Disney.
So. Walt Disney. Oh God!
So he's got decent physiognomy, that guy. Maybe he was in for fraud or something. Who knows? Okay, so
that's it. It was painted over metallic silver, and that was the end of it. But of course, Warhol, being a consummate businessman and wanting to salvage this, he took the same screens that he'd used to produce this mural and put them on canvas and produced the whole body of paintings of you know, that were ostensibly the same as the, you know, as the images on the mirror, except these were just printed on canvas just as Warhol's other images. And these are quite valuable now because there weren't that many of them produced. So, go on.
I quite like this series, you know.
Yeah. I mean, this, you know.
This was a good kid. He just fell in with the wrong crowd.
Yeah. Oh, nice bit of rough.
No, this one... this one's got dishonest nose, dishonest chin.
So anyway, and this is an installation view. I think this is at Sonnenbend. Or this may be at the Castelli.
There's Andrew Ryan again, look. That, yeah, I mean, literally is.
Yeah.
I think it's that thin moustache, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So, wonderful. All right, so and so we're going to go to just a brief foray. Again, Warhol produced another body of self-portraits. These are kind of the most sort of, I mean, this handling of color is kind of most associated with Warhol, but he didn't actually produce many paintings with this kind of almost psychedelic mod, you know, clashes of color. But he did famously produce a whole series of self-portraits. And remember that, you know, some of his earliest works were portraits of himself. And I'm going to go ahead. And, you know, endless variations produced.
Was he trying to beat Rembrandt? Because, you know, quantity was important. Like, was he
quantity
like...
quantity is very important. Yeah.
Rembrandt did, like, 28 self-portraits. I need to do 29.
Yeah. I would say that the psychological depth between a Rembrandt portrait, self-portrait in these, is quite different. But I quite like these pictures.
But of course, you know, I'm not a body language expert. Like Binary Surfer, but some people would say, well, is he trying to hide his face?
Yeah, well, again, I mean, this idea that the self-portrait is traditionally, I mean, back to Rembrandt, that the self-portrait is a medium that allows the artist to kind of explore his own psychological depth. And of course, with Warhol, his self-portraits are basically exposing his psychological state by hiding it, you know? I mean, these are I mean, they're barely portraits of a human. You know, they're entirely flat. They're half shade, half in shadow. You know, the hand in front of the face. You know, I mean, are they revealing or are they concealing? So it's a very interesting way to think about the self-portrait, that it reveals something of Warhol's character by basically hiding it. And, you know, they're presented in grids. And, of course, as with most of Warhol's work, there's different sizes. So there's a painting to match every lifestyle.
And, of course, the hair's not real.
And, again, there's a question whether the whole persona of Andy Warhol as to be consumed by the public was real either, you know. I mean, it's just one artifice after another. All right, so I want to. There's a whole bunch of images we're going to go through quickly here. This is another very famous series of paintings that Warhol produced. So I can't remember, as we've said, many of Warhol's series were kind of suggested by other people. You know, he painted money when someone said, "Well, why don't you paint what you love the most?" So he chose to paint dollar bills. So someone suggested, "Well, your works are all very urban. So, you know, they're all very kind of." You know, of the city and of the machine. Why don't you paint something pastoral? So, of course, Warhol, in his own kind of sardonic way, chooses to do the most artificial pastoral paintings of all time. I believe that this picture, and you can see that's the original, that's the source image on the left, was from a catalog selling seeds for these flowers. And so he, of course, adapted and made all the changes and produced, you can go to the next one. And you can see, I mean, these images, you know, ostensibly it's just copied from a photograph, but you can see the degree to which he is, of course, altering it, making changes to it to produce exactly the type of image he wants. You know, it's a bit deceiving to say that, you know, they're all ready made, because they were very heavily worked and heavily produced the source images. And so from this, he produced, again, another one of his most famous series, The Flowers. Do you want to go on?
There he is.
Doing some test prints. Yeah. And you see Gerard in the background. So what they're doing actually is, the way these paintings were produced is that there would be a base color. I mean, this is how a lot of Warhol's silkscreen work was done. The canvas would be painted a kind of base color, and then they're using stencil masks. You see the sort of cut out flower shapes, and they're spraying the colors on for each of the flowers, and then the silkscreen black would go on top of that to complete the image. So there was quite a bit of manipulation. You know, these they're not as mechanical, you know, Warhol's work is not as kind of hands-off and mechanical as it would seem, you know. And of course, when you see pictures of him working, he was heavily involved with the work. It wasn't like he was having other people do it for him. I mean, like many artists, both past and present, he had assistants help him with this enormous job. He produced hundreds of these pictures. So of course he's not going to be able to do it all himself. And so just as in the great studios of the past, you know, he had assistants and would be involved heavily in the work himself as well. And you sort of get a sense, yeah, there were many different sizes. These specifically went from very, very small to very, very, very large. And they were sometimes combined. Say you could have a single one, or you could have, as in the next one, double, triple, you know.
Yeah, all different colors.
You could see the scale of how many of these there are. They were at the time, all different colors to suit any mood.
I mean, what's this one here? What's going on?
That's a bit like if you remember the mustard race riot, where there's the car crash, where there's a blank and there's a printed side. Although this one's quite a bit. There's a lot of character to how the paint is applied, the pink paint is applied. But I think this is quite a large one. So. Also, I like this because it shows that, yes, Gerard and Warhol were diligently producing the paintings that provided the space for the people in the background to do whatever the hell they're doing. this is one of my favorite pictures of the... of him working, basically just this audience of people and this strange serpentine creature kneeling there working on his flowers.
See, Edie is sitting on the edge of the sofa there.
Edie there, and Chuck Wine and Gerard, a few other people, I don't know.
Okay, more flowers.
I put a lot of them in just to give you a sense of the kind of just amazing production overkill. And you could buy them in big groups. And this is how they were installed at Sonnabend. This is in his gallery in Paris. Iliana Sonnabend was Leo Castelli's wife, or she may have been ex-wife at this time, and she was his dealer in Europe. What?
Somebody walking around this gallery, like, what could you possibly say walking around this gallery? It's all just the same picture over and over again.
Well, it's also, again, I mean, you have to understand that these are all in different colors. I mean, so it's like so many of Warhol's work. It's this dichotomy. I mean, yeah, ostensibly these are meant to be kind of pastoral paintings, but they're so removed from the idea of you know, life and plants and such. I mean, they're you know, so it, once you're in a field of flowers, you're standing amongst literally dozens and dozens of these pictures, as if you're in a field of, you know, poppies. And I actually can't remember which what breed of flowers these are, but you know, but there are also these individual things which you can of course buy. You can buy little tiny ones, you can buy big ones. I do know for instance that the larger ones were $500. Not the huge ones, but the kind of medium large ones were $500 at the time. So, and now of course you don't get any of these flower paintings, the larger ones, for less than $1 million. So
let me just work out that for inflation. Is it 1965, was it?
1965, I believe. Yeah. Although they were produced for a couple of years.
So
yeah,
back then...
64, 65, yes.
Back then, $500 would have been equivalent of about $4,333 today.
Yeah, which is still quite cheap for a painting by a well-known, I mean, artist, almost unheard of. So it gives you a sense that, I mean, you know, this isn't the big ticket business that it's become, you know.
My brother just saying, literally churning them out, but... Literally, that's what the factory was.
He was churning them out. It was called the factory. They were churning them out. You know, production. I mean, I think Warhol I may have produced more of these flowers than any other thing that he'd done up to that point. I think that there's just so many of these. And I do think that there was something about the repetition of this image that really appealed to him. You know, it was the perfect thing. And it's, of course, a completely non-offensive subject, you know.
You can buy my painting big, you can buy it little, you can buy it medium, you can do it in blue, you can do it in red, you can do it in yellow. I got white ones for everyone.
You've got something for everyone, yes. And of course, you know, that was quite a controversial position. The very big ones there that you see on the left, I mean, those are going to stray into the $10 million range. The really big ones are quite expensive because there weren't that many of those. But they're all very, very expensive now. I think one of the women who became associated with Warhol's factory at this time was a woman called Ultraviolet, who was a French, sort of middle-aged French woman, I think, of some means. And her first contact with Warhol was going to the factory and buying one of these cash and carry. So famously, you could go through Leo Castelli and buy one of Warhol's works. But if you caught Warhol in the right mood, you could actually just go up to the factory and buy it and get a discount and just cash in hand. So she I described buying one of these paintings while it was still wet. And of course, you know, the smart ones of the Warhol crowd hung on to them and then minted, absolutely
sold later on. Yeah, if they lived long enough.
If they lived long enough. The strange thing, of course, is that Warhol wanted to, I mean, a lot of the people that were in the films, he wanted to pay rather than with money. He would try to pay them with artwork, and most of them didn't want it. You know, most of them said, you know, no, I want some money.
Short-sighted.
It was a high time preference. Yeah. They wanted a fix. You know, they wanted to go eat something. They didn't want one of these bloody paintings.
Well, Andy, we haven't eaten for 5 weeks.
No, don't you want one of these? Don't you want one of these pictures? Like, well, as I said,
you could live on some Campbell's soup for the next 5. You know,
Campbell's soup. Well, you could. You know, Campbell's soup was like, what, 10 cents a tin or something at this point.
Yeah,
so speaking of Campbell's soup, he did revisit the Campbell's soup at this point. I included these here because there's a whole series of pictures showing him and Gerard actually printing one of these pictures. So if you go to the next one, so you can sort of see the process of of doing the silk screens, printing the whole way through. So basically, with the soup tins, there wouldn't be a lot of underneath painting, like with flowers. So basically, you position the screen and you force the ink through it with a squeegee. And you know, if you've done everything correct, you get the print. And there we go. So, yeah, this new series of paintings were kind of in psychedelic colors. And it, to illustrate the surrealness of this whole thing, the Campbell Soup Company, I don't know, 10 years ago, actually produced a limited edition series of tins of tomato soup in these psychedelic colors, like in homage to Warhol. So it's so strange going the back and forth between a corporation and this strange artist.
And there's a cow.
Oh, so the cow. I need to just read a quick little excerpt to give you the story of the cows. I asked Ivan for ideas too. This is Ivan Karp, another one of Warhol's early supporters. Ivan Karp had a gallery, and then in the 90s, he actually opened, as part of the gallery, a cigar shop, because he was like a huge cigar fan. So I remember going, it was called OK Harris, and you could go and look at art, and then you could go and buy some cigars. I asked Ivan for ideas too, and at a certain point he said, you know, people want to see you. Your looks are responsible for a certain part of your fame. They feed the imagination. That's how I came to do the self-portraits. Another time, he said, why don't you paint some cows? They're so wonderfully pastoral and such a durable image in the history of art. Ivan actually talked like this. I don't know how pastoral he expected me to make them, but when he saw the huge cow heads, bright pink on a bright yellow background, that I was going to have made into rolls of wallpaper, he was shocked. But after a moment, he exploded with, they're super pastoral. They're ridiculous. They're blazingly bright and vulgar. I mean, he loved those cows, and for my next show, we papered all the walls in the gallery with them. So, yeah, Warhol actually... Yeah. He had commercial wallpaper made with his giant cow head. And if you go to the next image.
I've seen many kind of derivative works of this cow. Like, not this cow in particular, but
yeah.
Kind of, you know, restaurants and things copying, basically, like years later.
Yeah, a very, very famous thing. I mean, Warhol, strangely enough, hated this cow. Absolutely hated it, but he loved how effective it was. You know, if you go to the next one, and you can see how big the cow head actually was. Yeah, milking it. Someone says in the chat.
Why did he hate the cow?
He just didn't like it. He just hated the idea of this cow. But he also, I think, loved it because it was so. It is ridiculous. You know, why don't you be a pastoral artist? Why don't you paint a cow? Okay, I'm going to make a gigantic pink neon cow. And if you get in the next slide,
here we go. Look,
you can see how it was. Yes, so in
all my greatest hits in one place.
Yeah, and literally, he would hang the pictures on the cows. Oh my god.
Okay.
We're
gonna, like, have we got to 1966?
We've got to get. Yeah. God, do you have to run in it straight up, straight away?
There's the Velvet Underground and Nico.
Yeah, there's Velvet Underground and Nico. So, yes, of course, he met the Velvet Underground about this time, I think 1966. And let me just very quickly give you a little insight into that. Yeah, I'm looking through my book here, which has got a million little tabs. Here we go. As 1965 turned to 66, the big new interest at the factory was a group of musicians that called themselves the Velvet Underground. For New Year's, the Velvets, Edie, Paul, Gerard, and I all went to the Apollo Theater up in Harlem, then raced back down to watch ourselves on the evening news. Eventually, we passed out in front of the TV. Then later, When I went out on the street to go home, it was impossible to get a cab because of the great transit strike, blah, 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 blah. So yes, we met the Velvets through a filmmaker friend of Jonas Mika's named Barbara Rubin. So the Velvets sort of very quickly became kind of a house band of the factory. So if you want to go ahead.
Yeah.
So there they are. So yes, if people aren't aware, there's Lou Reed there, and Sterling Morrison, John Cale, Nico, and Mo Tucker. And Nico was not really a part of the Velvet Underground. I mean, she was associated with them early on, and certainly in the Warhol crowd, she was very much part of that liaison with them. But she only produced one. There's only one Velvet record with Nico on it. Maureen Tucker was the drummer. Apparently, was given the job as the drummer because she had an amplifier, or her brother had an amplifier that she could loan to Lou, and so he made her the drummer. And John Cale, of course, is a fellow Welshman.
Welsh, yeah. He'll be appearing on AA Radio this week, I think, actually. He has a track on the Boredom. On the Boredom one. Yeah.
All right, if you want to go ahead. So the Velvet Underground, I mean, they lived, I mean, you know, this was, again, very much the garage group par excellence. I mean, they lived together, you know, and their music, how would you describe their music, AA?
Avant-garde, pop rock. Sorry, art rock is how I describe it, not pop. Art rock would be the correct description for them. Yeah.
I mean, also, it was extraordinarily loud and heavy and raw for this time. I mean, you know, again, we've seen many, many, many groups of this type, but they were a very early, I would say one of the earliest kind of groups going into this territory. And probably most of the groups you kind of associate with genre are in one degree or the other aping things the Velvets did.
Did I ever tell you the story of how I was associated with the student radio station?
Yes.
I was a kind of mates with the station manager, but we had very different views on things. And I ran the arts thing, and he ran the station, and I had my own little department there. In fact, I told you before, they tried to vote me off for refusing to put on any plays or anything like that. But I remember once I put on the Black Angels Death Song, and he burst in. He's like, "What are you doing? What is this? I want you to play Blink-182." He just stubbornly played the entirety of the Black Angels Death Song by Velvet Underground and Nico.
So. Yes.
yeah.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. That's a particular... I mean, you could have gone with one of the pretty songs, you know.
I was being deliberately obtuse, as you can imagine. But, okay.
Keep going. There's more just Velvets. There's Lou and Andy. Also, that behind them is an acetate of a picture of Andy and Tennessee Williams. I'm wondering, there's Lou. There's Gerard, Lou, and Sterling Morrison at a cafeteria for some reason.
Nico.
There's old Nico, yeah. And there's a police raiding.
Where's the police officer again?
Raiding the factory. This is even noise. So, of course, the Velvets, I mean, they played incredibly loudly, certainly for the time. And, of course, it was very noisy material. And they would practice at the factory. Now, of course, this neighborhood that the factory was in 47th Street, was not a residential neighborhood. You know, I mean, this was very much a kind of commercial, industrial neighborhood. But even so, the volume of these people playing this music, I think eventually did garner complaints there as well. So, yeah, you see, he's turning down the amplifier volume. The cop.
Yeah. I want to say, by the way, I think because of Lou Reed's ego, that wasn't John Cale kicked out of the band as well? Like shortly, like not, he wasn't with them for that long.
Yes. Well, John Cale left.
I think he was kicked out, you know. I think he was unhappy. Lou Reed wants to be more poppy or something. But you still there, D? I think I've lost him. Hello? I think I lost him, you know. Lost him. D? I can't stand the sound of the Velvet Underground. Look at that. Look at that scene there. Amazing. D, I've lost you. Yeah, he's gone. I think we've lost his internet. Oh, well, we're out of time here, unfortunately. I'll have to notify D. Hold on. I have to wrap up. I have to wrap up. Okay. So, thank you very much, everyone. I guess we'll have to pick up whenever we manage to reach 1966. So a whole year in 3 hours. There are the Velvets with Nico and Andy Warhol. We'll come back to this soon. As I mentioned, I've got Foundations of Research live now. Oh, there's Dee. Hello, Dee.
Hello. Yes, my wonderful internet gave out, but yeah, I see you're wrapping up. But we'll have to get back. I knew we wouldn't get very far. I didn't realize as we go on, but I think it's quite interesting conversation. So hopefully
that whip, that's a bit dark, isn't it?
Yes, that's Gerard's thing, the whip. Venus and Furs, yes. I'll have to talk a bit about this because, of course, Warhol was the kind of presenter and producer, and famously
did the front cover.
And Warhol did the artwork, which, of course, if you go to the next slide, you'll see it's a vinyl banana, and you can peel it, and there's a flesh-colored fruit.
Yes,
and very cool. I think it says peel here and see.
Did he actually produce it?
Warhol produced this record in that he paid for the session. So he paid...
Executive producer.
He's paid the several thousand dollars. He is credited as the producer. And I think later on, Lou Reed said that in a sense, you could actually consider him the producer because he made the artistic decision to not do anything. And that was that's actually a valid production decision to basically just go into the studio and let them do what they wanted. And he was there for the sessions. And of course, in true Warhol fashion, they were great.
That's got to be the most dubious production credit in rock and roll history.
I can't remember who actually produced it. There was someone that was involved in the production. I can't remember what his name was, but. Warhol did pay for the session, so that record would not have been made without him. And of course, Warhol, basically promoted them. They became a kind of a multimedia show, and you sort of went through the slides. You can see, actually, this is the inside of the gatefold of the album, and that picture at the top is one of these shows, which are called the Exploding Plastic Inevitable. And it was the Velvets, and they would project Warhol's films. If you wondered where people would watch Empire or, Blowjob or any of these other things, they were projected often through colored filters onto the Velvets as they played. There would be Gerard Malanga in his leather bikini with a whip. There would be, a sort of early foray into disco lighting and smoke machines and glitter. It was a big happening in true mid-late 60s fashion.
Yeah, and I can see there part of the kind of discordance of the Velvet Underground sound at this time is John Cale's electric violin.
The electric
plays violin. On the Black Angels Death song, for example.
Yeah. Oh, Tom Wilson, yes. And Tom Wilson, of course, famously also produced Dylan. In fact, Tom Wilson, you can hear, if you know the song, the one about Captain Arab.
Yes, yeah.
117th Bob, Dream, I think it's
Bob called. Dylan's Dream or something, yeah.
Yeah, you can hear the fellow laughing at the beginning of that track. That's Tom Wilson, who was the producer, the actual producer of The Velvet Underground and Nico.
I mean, I think Tom Wilson did a lot of Dylan's, think he did Bringing It All Back Home,
yep.
Another Side, like all his early ones, possibly even Highway 61. But there's another guy called Bob Johnston who comes on the scene as well. So, yeah, he was definitely around. He was definitely around. Kind of a big, kind of a. He did it quite a lot. I seem to remember he was involved with Zappa at one point.
Yeah. He was definitely involved with The Mother's Invention and other people. He's got a quite a impressive track list. Died tragically young in the early 70s, I think. But
I played on AA Radio. I played a track on the space thing from. Sun Ra, who were a very unusual group.
I remember that video was something.
I think Tom Wilson was involved with Sun Ra at some point as well, if memory serves. But I could be wrong on that. People will have to double check. But okay. So let us stop then. We'll come back to possibly a part three, part four, part five, etc.
You're right. Yeah, Sun. He did produce a number of Sun Ra. He produced Simon and Garfunkel, Wednesday Morning, 3 a.m. Bob Dylan, Another Side. At times they had Change in This, Freewheeling, Mothers of Invention, Freak Out, Bringing It All Back Home, The Velvet Underground, Eric Burdon and the Animals, Soft Machine. I mean, hell of a run there.
Yeah, anybody who was anyone in that kind of underground, kind of 60s. There's a very distinct line, I would say, between the New York scene and the San Francisco scene, if you know the kind of 60s. Yeah. I will have a look at some super chats in a second. People are saying that they haven't seen any Zappa on AA Radio yet. That's because in the early AA radios, I was favoring songs that had videos. So because I wanted visuals. Now I've taken to making my own visuals. There's more of a chance of seeing Zappa, I would say. And in fact, you'll steadily see AA radio become less and less radio friendly as time goes on. yes. I think you'll be a fan of the ones coming up, Dee, because you like 20s impressionist cinema, don't you? Like the silent films and stuff. So I've mainly rated. I really like 20s experimental silent film, basically, and I've used a lot of those for my. If you get to know them well, if anybody can name all of the ones I use, you get a little prize.
I was having a good run. When you were doing
you had basically like seven or eight out of nine on that run, didn't you?
Yeah, I love a lot of these films. I mean, you had some bangers in there.
I mean, they're not that obscure. They're pretty famous ones. Most of the ones I've used because they tend to be the ones with the best visuals. I'm quite proud of the one I put together for this song called the Humdrum Blues. I've used a pretty famous one there, but anyway, let me have a look at the super chats. There's just one in Entropy by Years of the Eunuch. So here we are on day 45 of 2 weeks to show the Warhol. Just having a laugh, been greatly enjoying these streams. Big thanks to Dee for putting all this together. Yes, only three more shows to flatten the curve.
I mean, yeah, Warhol famously said, "In the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes." You know. Yeah, 15 minutes to flatten the Warhol curve.
Mm. And then let's have a look. I'll have a look in the main super chats, which are now working. Thanks, Daisy. In fact, I better actually reply to Daisy because I didn't reply to her.
Daisy's not a real person, is it?
Daisy's my. It's probably like Muhammad sitting in India or something.
Yeah.
Bourbon Chicken says, Are we not in the hands of a lunatic? If I were creating the world, I wouldn't mess about with daffodils and butterflies. I would have started with lasers, 8 o'clock, day one. That is, of course, from Time Bandits.
Yes.
David Warner's amazing diatribe. I might do a Gilliam stream one day. I kind of like his weird trilogy, you know, Brazil, Time Bandits, and the Adventures of Baron Munchausen. I think it's underrated, honestly. I wouldn't mind talking about Gilliam one. I might do some film stream soon. I was going to do, you know, if Triple A hadn't been ill, I was going to do my long review of Mary Poppins today.
Oh yeah, I wondered when that was going to happen.
But I'm actually glad that it worked out the way it is, because I just haven't had time, because I've been trying to write this. Who's ringing? Who dares ring me? Hold on. Hello. No. About 2 minutes. So Mrs. A ringing me, asking me if I finished.
God's sake.
Cringe Walker says, cooked by Susie. Harrison Wade says, would being asked to sign things at the event turn you inside out? Oh, sign things? What do you want me to sign?
You got to be like Warhol. Warhol would literally sign anything. One thing people used to do was that they would send a $2 bill. They would put a stamp, literally just put a stamp right on the bill and put Warhol's studio address and send it to him, and he would sign it and send it back. If you could hand him a soup tin, you could hand him a magazine, you'd hand him a toilet roll, he would sign anything that you put in front of him. So you need to be like that, eh?
Well, I bought myself some cigars, some quick smoke cigars, you know, like the little ones that don't take, you know, long. From, where are they from? Trying to see the name of these. There's a little Cohiba. There's one from Trinidad. There's like a whole different mix. And I basically bought them to take with me to the, like, to have some in my pocket, so I'd have a permanent excuse to disappear outside. I mean, I've seen it works out quite well. I can, I've seen I'm on the Friday. And basically, I'm not, I think, I mean, presumably I'm on the Unpopular Opinions Live, but that's at 9 o'clock. So, you know, I don't know if I'm expected to sit there from morning till night.
You've got to be like Warhol, tied to the chair, watching every single moment of your.
I might be outside smoking a cigar.
I'm bringing the Churchill. I'm not pissing around with a little cigarillo.
I do have some bigger one. I've got a massive. What's this one here? Jose. Don't know the name of it now. Jose La Piedra. Never had that before. A little Hoya. An Upman. I got one of these like sampler packs that you can get occasionally, you know.
Right.
Because I just needed something quickly, and I thought, well, I need little ones for travel.
I got this box of Nicaraguan ones with a parrot on them. You know, they're quite good. I just like the parrot. I buy cigars just because I like the artwork on the back.
I need more cigars, so people should buy Foundations of Research. It's only £50. I think it'll be a good work for people.
Yeah, if you want to get into A's good graces, give him a nice cigar at the event. How about that?
Matt says Andy Warhol would have loved Photoshop.
Yes.
Do you think he would have, wouldn't he?
Well, when we get to the 80s, Warhol did venture into early computer graphics, because the Amiga Computer Corporation, the Commodore Amiga, gave Warhol an Amiga upon which he did some very rudimentary artwork. So there's another thing that I'll mention. I'll read the entry, because one of my favorite little moments from his diary was a meeting, going to Yoko Ono's house for a party for Sean Lennon and meeting Steve Jobs. He was there. Steve Jobs met him. Yeah, in fact, offered him a Mac, but Warhol liked the Amiga better because the Mac was monochrome and the Amiga was color.
So, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. I may actually be back later on to do a special Super Chat stream. And I need to make a bloody video to advertise Foundations of Research. So you haven't heard the last of me today, folks, but I'm going to have to go. As you heard, I'm now being called. Well, thank you very much, Dee. We'll be back for part four, whether it's next week or in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whenever. In fact, next week, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to be at the event.
You're going to be at the event, yeah.
Maybe I'll do my Mary Poppins pre-record for next week. All right. Yeah. Thank you very much, Dee. It's been a lot of fun. I mean, I think going slowly is quite, you know, why rush? Why rush? We've got all the rest of time to take up.
I love it, and I just, you know, I love the irritation factor of it as well. You know, but I do think there's so many connected cultural moments to Warhol. It's about the time as much as it's about him.
I like to think, Dee, that it's what Andy would have wanted, not just one stream but like 10.
Yeah, the more the better. It doesn't matter how good they are,
and we should start to just repeat the same stuff, so rather than move on, just go back and look at them again and again and again.
Yeah, more is better. Go on.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sean. Most importantly, get out.